What's that, boy? Dad, over there! Is that a yeti?
It's just his hair, son.
At last! Saved after all these years! Stuck up this cursed mountain, licking moss with only a crow for a friend. How'd you find me?
Just walking the dog. Need a lift back down?
Run for a crow?
Adventures never far with the Land Rover Discovery Sport. Now £339 per month on Land Rover personal contract hire.
Oh, heated seats.
Land Rover. Above and beyond.
Initial rental £4,068. 48th month term. Subject status. 8,000 miles per annum. Conditions apply. Offer ends 31st of March. Participating retailers only. Such Land Rover offers.
It's business time, baby.
The Sala Monster sounds off.
My client!
Mama Monster!
Conquered the street!
You like fighting a woman?
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
Come over here and fight me!
Delete! You haven't been beat up properly! Woo!
Welcome to episode 585 of the Sala Monster Sounds Off for Sunday, February 10th. 2019. I am the Sala Monster. I was very sorry before I started recording to see the news item that Salvatore Bellomo passed away at the age of 67, died from cancer. He was probably mostly known as a perennial job guy in the WWF in the early 80s, actually early to mid 80s, I would say. You know, famous for interrupting an old Piper's Pit segment where Piper made fun of him, called him a pizza guy. So I don't know that he had a whole lot of claim to fame other than that in WWE, although he did have a brief stint apparently in the early days of ECW, and it was still Eastern Championship Wrestling. But he was sort of one of those mainstay names that if you were an older fan from back then, not that I'm trying to date anybody here, but if you were an older fan from that early to mid-80s time period, you probably know that name, Sal Bellomo. So he just passed away. Last night was a thrill for me. You can probably hear it in my voice. I had the chance to call my first Pentagon Jr. match at the House of Glory show in Queens alongside JD from New York, Matthew Ryan Shapiro, and Benvenuto. Let me back up a little bit here. So on Friday, the same night that the Lucha Brothers, Pentagon of Phoenix, were on television beating LAX to win the Impact Tag Team titles in a match that was taped many weeks earlier, that same night they won the AAW Tag Team titles from AR Fox and Myron Reed at the promotion's Lucha City Limit show that was taking place in Austin, Texas. Unfortunately, in that match, Phoenix suffered an injury. He was hurt. In that match, that resulted in the Lucha Bros against the LAX tag team match that was planned for the House of Glory show last night to be canceled in light of Phoenix's injury. It was thought that he might have suffered a more serious injury at first, or even a stinger. Apparently that wasn't the case. He suffered a muscle contusion in his neck. This was on a stunner, a move that he's probably done 100 times before. And I guess just the way that he landed, he was in a lot of pain, and he did not get up. And Pentagon did go on to score the fall for his team, so they still won the titles. But Phoenix had to be stretchered out. I think they stretchered him out on a table. I don't even think they had a gurney. And they took him to a waiting ambulance, then took him over to the hospital. I don't know if he's still in the hospital or not. My sense of it, though, is that he'll only have to miss a few weeks. Last night, obviously, he was not going to be in any shape. I don't even think to fly, let alone to wrestle on the HOG show. So instead of doing the Lucha Bros against LAX last night, it ended up being the unlikely team of Pentagon and Sami Callihan against LAX. It was a pretty wild match. Sami and Pentagon have had their issues in the past. If you're an Impact fan, you know of their issues on Impact. But they were partners last night. And no, the alliance actually did not last very long. I think it was Sami who late in the match tried to make the first move on his partner, which didn't work out too well for him. But it was a wild match. It really was. They were brawling into the crowd. And you know, from where we were doing the announcing, we couldn't even see half of what was going on there. I saw spit and chairs flying, all kinds of things flying. I was grateful that we weren't sitting ringside for the match. Overall, it was a, you know, these HOG shows, they have, it's a mix of homegrown talent and names that you would recognize. They have a lot of big names that have passed through the promotion over the years. They always put on a very good show. Unfortunately, they had two, not one, but two rope breaks, literal rope breaks on the show. In the opening match, the top rope snapped. And that's never a good thing, let alone in the opening match of the show. So that ended up delaying things a little bit once that match was over. And then a little bit later on, I think two matches later maybe, or maybe even the next one, the rope broke again. And so it was just a total disaster as far as the ring ropes were concerned. After intermission, they had some new ropes driven in, and everything went off without a hitch for the remainder of the night. But yeah, you feel bad in that situation because the people who were in the ring, first of all, you don't want anybody to get hurt. There was a really scary moment in that second match, the second time the rope broke, where I think somebody fell out of the ring. I didn't actually see it. I think it was Ken Broadway. I heard the noise, and it was a very scary moment, but he was okay. But you worry about the safety of the guys, because they keep going. You know, the show doesn't end. They keep going, and guys are trying to do moves off the post with the broken rope, getting chance of please don't die. It'd be very easy for somebody to get very hurt, but that did not happen. The next show is going to be the day before WrestleMania. That's obviously going to be a very big weekend for a whole bunch of different promotions. And House of Glory is running, I think, a 2 p.m. matinee show on Saturday, April 6th. So anybody who is going to the Ring of Honor New Japan show at Madison Square Garden later that night can make it. You know, just have to travel from Queens to Manhattan, but you should be able to hit up both shows if you want to. And House of Glory is going to be stacking up that show. They already announced the Great Muta and Tajiri. I think they're going to be teaming up, in fact, on that show. The first time ever in the United States that those two are teaming up. I know they've got some other surprises up their sleeves, so it's always a good time. I always say if you're a local fan, if you live in the New York area or even on the outskirts of New York, you should check it out. That weekend, there's going to be a whole influx of fans coming in for WrestleMania. So wherever you are from, if you are coming into town, I don't know what you're doing in the middle of the day that Saturday, but definitely consider picking up a ticket for that show. Thank you to everybody who continues to support the podcast via Audible. Please keep doing so. Use our link, audibletrial.com/solomonster. Sign up for the 30-day trial. Get yourself a free audiobook of your choice. Lots of wrestling books on there to choose from. And you can get it for free. audibletrial.com/solomonster. Also use the promo code SOLOMONSTER if you're signing up for a new Lyft account. I just used Lyft last night. It's great. So if you want to get a few bucks off your first ride, the promo code is SOLOMONSTER. Very simple. Lastly here, I want to say thank you and shout out all the people who donated to the podcast this week via PayPal. I appreciate you. I love you all. $10 or more will get you a nickname and a shout out here on the show like these fine folks. The Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton. John Loose Cannon Lopez. The Florida Freebird, Bryant Becerra. Beast Mode, Brock Joseph. Dastardly Derek Smith, Brett Brickfist Brode, Luis Hercules Hernandez, the Malaysian Mastermind Samuel T, Stephen Handyman Halistick, Brian the Cleaver Carpenter, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, the Anarchist Andrew Heller, the Five Tool Player Adam Bartolo, the Sydney Brawler Ben Hobson, Super Jock Michael Cochran, Tim Attack Before the Bell DeWolf, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine Harrison Soep, and Josh the Shooter Stockton. Also want to wish a happy birthday to Ron. He has been a listener of the podcast since 2013. He turned 40 on Friday. They say that 40 is the new 30 or something like that. In a few years, I'll be saying that just to make myself feel better. Wilfredo Pandemonium Flores is running a new contest giveaway on Instagram, at David Porkchop. That is the handle on Instagram, at David Porkchop, for a free Android Gembox system, which is a $50 value, and a $10 Domino's Pizza gift card. So you can enter right now, all the way through February 15th, which I believe is this coming Friday. It ends at midnight Eastern. You have up until that point. You can enter. Just find the post on Instagram, like it, sub to him, and tag two people. That's all you got to do. Get yourself a free Gembox system and a Domino's Pizza gift card. You'll be in the running for that. Orange Corn, thank you. He says he listens to the show on his commute. And 91 Neff says he looks forward more to this podcast than he does to Raw or SmackDown. I can't tell you how many people I hear that from. SmackDown, yeah, SmackDown's got its good weeks. Raw, I could totally understand that. But yes, Orange Corn and 91 Neff, thank you for the kind words on iTunes and the reviews on there. I appreciate that. We passed 47,000 subs on YouTube this week. That's pretty cool. Thanks to everybody who has taken the time to subscribe on there for all of the bonus sound-off content, pay-per-view reviews. That's what the channel is for. Only 3,000 more. We hit 50K. So if you are not subscribed already, please do so. Help us on the road to 50,000. Red alert! Red alert! I'm about to talk about All Elite Wrestling. I know this triggers violent seizures in some people, so I'm giving you fair warning. All Elite Wrestling streamed its Double or Nothing press conference from the MGM Grand in Las Vegas on Thursday. They held it outdoors by the pool area. I saw the pool behind the podium, and I instantly was reminded of the old Spring Break Nitros at Club La Villa. And the only thing that would have made this better, honestly, is Kevin Nash doing cannonballs into the pool. I enjoyed it. You know, it's again this unbelievable avalanche of hatred that I see online for All Elite Wrestling. For every one person, it seems like, who's excited and hopeful and optimistic about this, you've got five or six people who just shit all over it and seemingly just don't want to give this thing a chance. It really is something else. And it didn't come across to me as minor league at all. I mean, look, they were streaming a press conference and we had people complaining, oh, look, minor league. Well, it's not a television production. I don't know what people were expecting. It didn't come across to me as being minor league. It's just, it's unbelievable. Like, these people, many of these people, are really crossing over into looking for any reason at all to shit on All Elite Wrestling right now. Probably because they're just sick of hearing about it. And then other people may have their own hidden agenda. Some people don't like the people involved. Everyone seemingly has their reason. I think a lot of people are just sick of hearing about it. But they just take every opportunity to shit all over it. Now, some people think it's all hype. Maybe it is. You know, are they a pretender? Or are they the real deal? Well, here's a suggestion. Why not wait until their first show before banishing them to the scrap heap of failed wrestling experiments, of which there are many. There have been many attempts over the years to either compete with WWE or to start some big promotion. They have some kind of money mark or somebody behind it. Yes, we've heard these stories before. Give it time before banishing them into the same category. Tickets go on sale this week for their Double or Nothing show, May 25th. Very likely to sell out. They've gotten over 14,000 ticket requests already on the AEW website. That's for a building in the MGM Grand Garden Arena that seats around 14,000 or so once the stage and setup is all taken care of. The pre-sale kicks off, for those who are interested, on Monday, so tomorrow at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. The general public will then get access on Wednesday at noon Eastern. And I'm curious to see what ticket prices they charge. Cody tweeted at somebody and said that they have scaled and priced the show below the market average, like they did for All in Chicago. So makes it sound like it'll be affordable for the people who want to attend. It's still Vegas, and obviously if you want a really good seat, you're going to have to pay top dollar, but still curious to see what those ticket prices look like when they go on sale this week. Watching the stream, watching the little party they were having on Thursday, it looks like Alex Marvez and Excalibur may be the announce team for AEW. I have no idea if Conrad Thompson is going to be part of the actual announce crew. My guess would be no. He was handling some of the hosting duties. And so I'm sure he'll be sort of affiliated with them in some way. I could see him doing maybe like a, you know, co-hosting a pre-show type deal. Obviously, he's affiliated with the StarCast events that they've done. But as far as an actual announced team is concerned, it looks like it's going to be Alex Marvez and Excalibur. And Excalibur, from what I've heard of him, I think he was on the All In broadcast they did last year. And I think he's done some commentary for New Japan as well. Is very good. So we'll see what the final team looks like once they actually get TV. So just going through the event real quick here, they made a bunch of announcements, had a bunch of appearances by different wrestlers, big names, not so big names. One name that you may not have been familiar with, Sonny Kiss, made an appearance. You may know him better as Exolicious from Lucha Underground. I was a fan of his work on that show. He's not going to move the needle at all. He's not a difference maker or anything like that, but he's entertaining enough from what I've seen of him to have on the roster. You've got Sammy Guevara. Another familiar face from Lucha Underground. He's currently the AAA Cruiserweight Champion. He made an appearance. He'll be a Double or Nothing as well. Adam Hangman Page was there. He tweeted out yesterday, bizarrely, that his parents inherited an old farmhouse and found a human skull inside. There's your useless piece of information for the week. I'm sure Pac don't care. He was at the event via satellite. He cut a promo on Adam Page, and they made the match official later on between the two of them for Double or Nothing. It will be Pac against Adam Page on May 25th. The Young Bucks spoke. They introduced the best friends, Chucky T and Trent Beretta. They are also in AEW. New Japan was said to be none too happy that they got Beretta. Beretta went from New Japan to All Elite. I guess they had plans for him. Well, plans change, as they say. The Lucha Brothers showed up, Pentagon and Phoenix. This was 24 hours before Phoenix got hurt at the AAW show. They attacked the Bucks. Pentagon gave Matt Jackson a package pile driver on the stage. That would seem to be the match for Double or Nothing. It seems like they're setting up the Young Bucks against the Lucha Brothers. And the Lucha Brothers is a big get. I don't know that they're exclusive, at least not yet. A lot of people aren't necessarily exclusive. I'll talk about that in a second. To AEW, but, you know, those are two of probably the most in-demand people, the most in-demand act, maybe, on the independent scene right now. I mean, these guys are traveling all over the place, all over the world. You know, I mean, just look at this past week, right? I mean, they were in Vegas for this press conference for All Elite. The next night, they were in Austin, Texas for the AEW show. Phoenix got hurt. He had to stay behind, but then Pentagon flew to Queens in New York to work the House of Glory show last night, and who knows where he's off to today. So these guys are in demand. They're a very hot act right now. They have tag team titles in multiple different places. And so this is a big get for the audience that they're catering to. This is a big get for AEW and for this focus that they want to have. I've heard them talk about having a renewed focus on tag team wrestling and how tag team wrestling can, you know, headline shows. They really want to put an emphasis in a way that WWE, certainly on Raw at least, certainly is not focusing at all on tag team wrestling in a way that I think they should be. Having these two as part of your tag team division, that's a big get. SCU was there. Daniels, Kazarian, and Scorpio Sky, they spoke for a little bit. Brandy, of course, Brandy was there, and she was talking about women's wrestling and announced two additions for the Double or Nothing show. They are bringing in the Japanese legend herself, Aja Kong, who is almost 50 years old and I am sure is probably no less of a badass now than she used to be. You're never too old to deliver a spinning backfist. Always remember that. My younger self will never forget the Survivor Series in 95. I don't remember who it was that she hit. I don't think it was Alundra Blaze. They had this women's Survivor Series elimination match. And this was right before they made the decision to just disband the entire division. And then I think maybe a month later, Alundra was dropping the women's title in the garbage can on Nitro. But they had a women's elimination match. And Aja Kong was in that match. WWF had brought her in to feud with Blaze. And she hit at least one person. Maybe it was Alundra. She hit somebody with a spinning back fist. I thought it broke my jaw when I first saw that. So anyway, I haven't seen her wrestle in a long time, but she'll be there at Double or Nothing. And also, Tokyo Joshi's Yuka Sakazaki will be in Vegas on May 25th as well. Brandy also introduced Kylie Rae is an official member of the AEW roster. She started out of Booker T's Reality of Wrestling School 3 years ago. And then finally, she introduced Nyla Rose, who had a face-off with Kylie. Rose is the first transgender wrestler to sign with a major promotion. Major in that it has big money behind it. I understand they haven't run a show yet, but... And here's the thing about it, and maybe they still will, and you can throw it in my face, but it hasn't seemed like they've really made a whole big deal or a whole big spectacle about it. I was joking with somebody last night who didn't even realize that, you know, Nyla Rose was probably the first transgender wrestler to really sign with a big company like this, and didn't even realize that because, as I said to them, I said, yeah, you didn't realize it because they didn't put a whole big press release out about it. They didn't, you know, they didn't run a ticker on the bottom of the screen during the stream for the press conference. If WWE, if this were WWE, forget about it. She'd be making the rounds on all the morning news shows. You'd have 15 different press releases going out about it. Somehow Stephanie McMahon would take credit for it. It would be ridiculous. So I kind of like the understated nature of the way that they're doing things here. They're just signing people who they think can contribute in some way. And there's going to be names like that that none of us are probably even really familiar with. It's important for these people because all of a sudden they're going to get a platform. You know, I don't know. Look, Lucha Underground came along. Lucha Underground did not have what you would consider a huge television audience. I mean, I would love to go back and check at their peak. And I think that the ratings information for El Rey, I don't know how accessible it is, but I don't know that an episode of Lucha Underground ever did more than, you know, on El Rey, maybe in the range of 150 to 200,000. I mean, I'm just spitballing here, but it never had this huge audience. If it did, then it would still be going for season 5, 6, and 7. And we don't even know if there's going to be another season. And it never had any buzz beyond its little base of hardcore fans. But the reason I bring this up is because I, for example, became familiar with a lot of new people watching Lucha Underground. People like Pentagon, people like Phoenix. You know, people, wrestling fans, certain wrestling fans, probably had heard those names and maybe knew who they were, but a lot of them didn't. One of the reasons Pentagon and Phoenix are so hot right now, they can thank Lucha Underground for that. And you can name a whole bunch of other names, too, that have come out of that show. Brian Cage, other people who really made a name for themselves on Lucha Underground. Didn't have a massive television audience, but look at what they've been able to parlay that into. They've made a lot of money off that popularity from the show. So who's to say that some of these names we're not really overly familiar with right now, once All Elite finally starts running shows and announces a TV deal, whatever network or networks it may be, that you're not going to have a whole new crop of wrestlers who we wouldn't know otherwise, who are able to parlay that into something much bigger. And if they're still able to work independence and they're not exclusive to AEW, you know, they could be the next generation of Pentagons or Phoenixes who go out and work all over the place and make a shit ton of money. So I suspect we're going to be hearing about more of these lower names soon. But they did announce one big name at the end of this event on Thursday, and that was the worst-kept secret in wrestling, that Kenny Omega has in fact signed with All Elite Wrestling. He told Dave Meltzer later on that it is a 4-year deal. So this is not a year-long or a 2-year small commitment. It's 4 years. He'll be either, how old is he now? He's probably going to be either 40 or close to 40. By the time this contract expires. So you talk about all in. This guy is all in with All Elite. He's putting all of his eggs in this basket. He was talking a little bit about the deal he has. It does allow him to work more with New Japan if they can work something out. Right now they have nothing worked out. I sense there could be even a little bit of, I don't want to say heat, but, you know, maybe not a lot of happiness with how things sort of went down there at the end with Omega and New Japan, but he's allowed to work more if he'd like to with New Japan in the future and do other projects as well. That's one of the things that he said he liked about this deal is that it allows him to do things outside of wrestling, whether it's video game related. You know, he's got that HBO, I think HBO Canada documentary coming out that he is really about him and his career. That's coming out soon. So he made an interesting comment in talking to Meltzer in that interview. where he said that New Japan was the third best option that he had available to him between AEW, WWE, and New Japan. He ranked New Japan at the bottom of that list and said they were the third best option that I had. The other two were more excited to have me, he said. So clearly, like I said, throwing some shade at New Japan, but still very much open to working with them in the future. Is the feeling mutual? I don't know. We'll have to wait and see. One thing that struck me, though, in him making the announcement and thinking about what could have been with him in WWE, and I think he made the right decision here. I really, as cool as it would have been, I think, to see him in WWE, I think he did make the right call and probably will be a lot happier for it, and I'm sure he's going to make a ton of money. But it was a couple of years ago in an interview that he said one, or maybe the one, big reason that he would want to go to WWE, and this was only a couple of years ago, is he wanted a WrestleMania match against AJ Styles. He said that before I, you know, my health starts to deteriorate and before AJ hangs it up, because AJ's, what, 41 now, he wanted one big match with Styles on the biggest stage possible. I don't know what WWE's plans are for AJ Styles this year at WrestleMania. They're not really clear to me right now. But he doesn't seem to have any obvious opponent. I think this was Omega's chance. If he really wanted that match, AJ has no better opponent right now. If he really wanted it, I think this is the year he could have gotten that match. He could have said, look, I want to sign with you guys, but I've got certain things I'd like for us to agree upon first. One of them being, I'd like to work with AJ at Mania. And you know what? WWE probably would want him bad enough, they probably would have given it to him. So, AJ Styles versus Kenny Omega at WrestleMania 35. What might have been? But he opted to sign instead with AEW. Probably, you know, if we're being honest here, probably after realizing that when that WrestleMania match was over, what happens to me then? Right? I got my match in 2 months. Great. Okay, now it's over. Now what? Now what's going to happen? But, you know, I have to be fair about this, though. For all the shit that gets slung at WWE and the people they've mishandled or mismanaged, AJ Styles is one of the real, true success stories in how, you know, he's been booked by WWE since the company, you know, signed him up, since he came over to the company. He's been a superstar the entire way through, pretty much a headliner almost the entire time, really, that he's been with the company. A year as a WWE champion, top star on SmackDown. Clearly, Vince has a lot of respect for him. Supposedly, Vince even made the comment to him at one point, I wish I would have signed you 10 years ago. You could have been, you know, my new Shawn Michaels. That's high praise coming from Vince McMahon. And it's also one of the reasons why I'm sure AJ is not going anywhere. I'm sure he is staying put. He is not leaving, although that's not official, because he's a made man there. He's a made man there. There's no reason for him to leave if he can get, you know, the kind of schedule that he wants out of him. If he doesn't want to work as many dates, if they can agree to that, then what incentive, what reason is there for him to leave other than, oh, my friends work in this other company? Yeah, but he's got friends in WWE. You know, it's not like he's the, you know, the antisocial kid on the playground who's kind of kicking dirt and doesn't have anybody to talk to. If WWE, believe me, WWE is not going to let this guy go, not without a fight. I don't see him going anywhere. But Omega announced that he too, much like Cody and the Bucks, was now going to be an executive vice president in All Elite Wrestling. How many executive vice presidents does this company have? I counted four. I feel like I'm missing someone. Four executive vice presidents, I think it is. The best part was after the event, Cody was talking. He was trying to explain what that means. You're executive vice president. Okay, well, what does that mean? He's executive vice president. He's got the same title. What does that mean? What does that role entail? He says, we're going to figure that out. We're going to figure that out. What it is exactly. We have to figure that out. It's like, it sounds nice, but we don't know what it actually means yet. Just give us time. We'll figure it all out. Chris Jericho then interrupted Kenny Omega. Got into a shoving match with him. This is probably going to headline, I would imagine, the show on May 25th. I don't have a problem with that. Yet another thing I saw people complaining about They've wrestled, yes, they've wrestled before. They've wrestled once. Once! And that was over a year ago. By the time Double or Nothing rolls around, it'll be about 18 months since the one and only match they had, which, by the way, did very nice business for New Japan. Now, Omega won that match clean. I can see Jericho winning the second match and then building to a rubber match on the next big show that they do later in the summer. But you want to headline your first show with at least one big name. Jericho is probably, not even probably, I'm sure Jericho is more well-known as far as a, quote, mainstream name. I'm not saying Jericho is Hulk Hogan or anything like that, but certainly more than Kenny Omega. He's a recognizable name from WWE. He does music and other things as well. He even hosted a game show on ABC for all of 5 minutes. But having him and then Omega, who to wrestling fans is a well-known, you know, big name, that's exactly what they need to be doing for this show. They need to have at least one big match like that at the top of the card. And we still don't even know the entire AEW roster yet. You know, there's going to be more big names announced possibly before May, before the first show even happens. I mean, you know, I have a list here of the roster as it stands, right? There's been a lot of talk about different names. Here's the way the AEW roster looks as of today. We've got Chris Jericho and Kenny Omega. They're sort of right at the top of the list there. Now, there was an interesting note on the Cage Side Seats website this week about Kota Ibushi being expected to work, and Kenny Omega said as much, that it won't happen right away, but he fully expects that we're going to see Kota Ibushi in AEW. Now, I would have to assume that Ibushi is still going to freelance in Japan, and, you know, I mean, the guy's like a horny bachelor, you know, he's not interested in a committed relationship. He just cannot commit to one person. He cannot commit to one place. But even still, you know, if they get Ibushi, hey, we may get that championship match between Kenny Omega and Kota Ibushi. Just not at Madison Square Garden. We'll get it for a completely different promotion, for a completely different title, but it's still possible. Cody and Brandy, the Young Bucks, Hangman Page, SCU, Pac, the Lucha Brothers. We've also got Joey Janela and Penelope Ford, or Penelope, as Booker T called her on his show. I gotta tell you, I mispronounce names a lot too. I get some weird ass names sometimes on this show, no offense, and I can butcher them as well as anybody. I don't know that I've ever heard anybody butcher the name Penelope. I've never heard. I just have never heard Penelope as a pronunciation of that. I love Booker. I really do. Penelope. It's like, it sounds like a fruit. It sounds like a fruit that you would eat, like cantaloupe or something. Anyway, so Joey Janela and Penelope are in AEW. We've got the best friends, Beretta and Chucky T. We've got MJF, Seema, Jungle Boy, Jimmy Havoc, Sammy Guevara, Britt Baker, Sunny Kiss, the former Exolicious I mentioned, Kylie Rae, Nyla Rose, and of course they're bringing in Aja Kong and Yuka Sakazaki for that first show. They've also announced partnerships so far with AAA and OWE out of China. I suspect there'll be more partnerships announced in the future. You would think that this is going to be a natural landing spot for Marty Scurll in a few months after his contract is up with Ring of Honor. I'm sure he'll be on his way in. And who knows who else? Remember, Jericho said they had about 6 to 8 names on their list of targets. I don't know if that was all from WWE. It might be. Those are the people that they're still eyeballing to bring in. And then there's Dean Ambrose, who is leaving. All of a sudden, all these people who at first were like, oh, it's a work. You're being worked, Sala Monster. It's a work, bro. It's a work. All of a sudden, boy, they shut up real quick, didn't they? Boy, they shut up real fast. Dean Ambrose is going to be gone from WWE in a few months, and it's not a guarantee that he'll be in All Elite, but I'd say there's a pretty good shot that that's where he'll end up, you know, at least for that Double or Nothing show in May. So I look at this, and there's still a few pieces missing. They need a couple more big names. I really think they need a couple more, and Dean Ambrose could be one. He would be a big name, but there's got to be somebody even bigger than him. I think they get two more people like that, and then just keep adding some tag teams. They need more women on the roster for the women's division, And then I think they'll have a full roster for a two-hour television show. I just don't think they're there yet. But you do that, those put those pieces in place, and I think they'll be in good shape. The TV show, if I had a guess, I don't think it's coming until the end of the year. Fall at the earliest, maybe not even until early next year. So it's not like they're going to be on TV anytime soon in the next few months. We still have a ways to go before that. But a lot of these deals, again, I don't think are exclusive, at least not yet. So these people may be part of the AEW roster, but they're not necessarily exclusive to them. They're still working for MLW. They're still working for other promotions. And you look at something like the Phoenix injury from Friday night, thank God it wasn't anything too serious, but that's always the risk you run by allowing guys to wrestle elsewhere. It's sort of a double-edged sword, right? You're more likely to sign people and be appealing to people if they know that, hey, I'm not tied down to this one company. I could still work for my hometown promotion, or I could still, you know, book my own shots and travel and do independent dates. So you get access to all of these different names that maybe WWE wouldn't in some cases because they're not willing to play ball. But you're also at the mercy of other promotions, right, when it comes to other injuries. So, like I said, a double-edged sword there. There was a very interesting, I wanted to mention this real quick here because I was reading an old Observer this week from 2002. This was right after the Royal Rumble where Mr. Perfect returned to WWE. I remember how excited I was to see Mr. Perfect back. And he looked like the Mr. Perfect of old that night. He was in the final three or four, I think, in that Royal Rumble. He was right there at the end with Kurt Angle and Triple H and Stone Cold Steve Austin. I don't know what happened after that. I really, you know, to say that they screwed the pooch on Kurt Hennig and didn't do more with him that they could have is a huge understatement. But that night, the Mr. Perfect of old was back. Anyway, I pulled this because the timing was just eerily perfect with everything that's going on in wrestling right now. Now, mind you, this was 17 years ago, but this was the passage from The Observer. The return of Mr. Perfect being put over like a major player seems to signify more clearly what privately most in wrestling have talked about over the past 2 weeks. Kurt Hennig has been available for a year since WCW let him go, but he was the planned XWF world champion. XWF was this new promotion that was going to be starting. I think they even had Jimmy Hart and Hulk Hogan's name was attached to it. So anyway, he was the planned XWF world champion. Now that other companies are making noise, it is clear that part of the reason for these acquisitions is to nip anyone from getting off the ground. The more things change, the more they stay the same. I read that and I just thought, huh, that's interesting. At the event in Vegas, Cody was asked if he has ever used WCW as some sort of inspiration for AEW. Now, I think this may have just been blown out of proportion. I didn't actually see the interview, so I can't tell if he said this with a smile on his face or not. But I could see why this would give people pause, you know, when you read these, because what he said, when you read his comments. It sounds super romantic when you think about it. Dusty Rhodes feuded with Vince McMahon, and he lost. And here is his youngest son who is going to go and try to cut Vince's head off. In the back of my mind, when it's just me, I think about it a lot. But then I have these guys with me who have different visions. You can't turn the clock on old wrestling. WCW is friggin' awesome, he says. What AEW is going to be is a whole separate animal. He thinks about it a lot when he's by himself, which is understandable. So long as he understands that can't be the engine that fuels this thing, right? If the mindset going into this is to make AEW as successful as it can possibly be, and yes, that means irritating WWE when it comes to signing away and competing for free agent names, and maybe even having people jump ship when their contract is up and going from WWE to AEW. There's going to be some of that going on. It's unavoidable. That just, you know, comes with the territory. But focus on making AEW as great as it can be. Focus on giving the fans what they want to see at a time when WWE really is not. You focus on that, you're going to do well. If this thing starts out as some kind of revenge fantasy, it will fail. I don't care how much money is behind it, it will fail. Funny thing about the whole cutting Vince's head off thing, to somehow avenge the death of WCW is that WCW did more to kill itself than Vince McMahon did. That and Jamie Kellner at Turner. You want the man who killed WCW, there's your guy. It's not Vince McMahon, it's Jamie Kellner. He didn't like wrestling, he pulled the plug on WCW on the Turner networks. Bye-bye. And Eric Bischoff's deal that he had so meticulously put together to acquire the company, he was going to reboot the company, all of a sudden, poof, went up in smoke once they lost that TV. Competition is a great thing. I want to see this thing succeed. Romantic as it may be to think about, it cannot be about revenge. The best revenge is being successful. Focus on that. Now, Randy Orton was tied in to AEW this week. Everybody is getting sucked into the AEW vortex here. This week, it was Randy Orton's turn. Started with a tweet from the WrestleVotes account on Twitter, which claims to have inside sources, and I do believe they have broken some legitimate, you know, news before. In other situations, though, they post very vague tweets that don't really offer a whole lot of information. It'd be very easy to claim, no matter what the outcome is, that they knew what was going to happen. So, some people buy into it, some people don't. Buyer beware, as with anything on the internet. But they posted a tweet that got a lot of people buzzing this week, claiming that the first real shot in this supposed war, I guess, has been fired. And that a source said that AEW has made a, quote, outstanding offer to a current big-time WWE superstar. An offer that's almost too good to turn down. Now, they wouldn't reveal who the name was for fear of exposing their sources. It's vague enough that I wasn't even going to mention it when it was first getting picked up. I wasn't even going to mention it. But then Sean Ross Sapp over at Fightful.com looked into it. He reported that the name being referenced in that tweet was not AJ Styles, which was my first thought when I first read that. If this is legit, who would it be? AJ was the first name that popped into my head. The second name that popped into my head was Shinsuke Nakamura. I have not yet heard that he has signed a new deal. His deal is supposed, I believe, up in April, and I haven't heard anything about him signing a new deal. Turned out to not be either one of those guys. The name was Randy Orton. The same Randy Orton who has spent his entire professional career with WWE. He has been a lifer in that company. Now, Fightful clarified that they were told Orton was not offered a contract, only, you know, because he's under contract right now to WWE. So this whole thing about how a contract offer was made is bullshit. That never made any sense. In fact, back in 2010, the Observer at the time reported that Orton had signed a new long-term deal with WWE that was said to be 10 years in length. So that would not be up until next year, barring any sort of, you know, out clause or something in his contract that we wouldn't know about. They said, though, the Fightful report said that he was not offered a contract, only that he has openly stated, I guess behind the scenes, his willingness to talk to AEW if they were interested. He would be open to talking with them and open to the idea possibly of going there. But that's like me saying, like, I'd be open to being in a committed relationship with Katrina from Lucha Underground. Yeah, no shit, I would be. But that doesn't mean it's actually going to happen, right? So you got to pay attention to words here. Although, if they ever do reach a deal with Orton, I sure hope it's not a handshake agreement. That's all I can say about that. But Fightful also spoke to a source of theirs at AEW. They said to Fightful, look, we're not interested in tampering. Our recruitment is more targeted to fresh, young talent, independent talent. They claimed, if anything, this was probably a story that was planted by somebody to gain leverage in some kind of contract negotiation. And this is something that I think is important for people to understand about these stories. We're going to be seeing and hearing a lot more of these types of stories going forward. In the months to come, the weeks and months to come, because there's going to be wrestlers and there's going to be agents looking, not necessarily to jump to AEW, but looking to leverage more money out of WWE. WWE, I mean, the money is falling out of their pockets right now. I'm going to talk about their business in a few minutes here, because they just had their biggest quarter in the history of the company. They are flush with cash, this company, right now. And a lot of it, Saudi Arabia, the TV money that's going to be coming in. That's where a lot of this money, frankly, is coming in right now. It's certainly not coming from live event revenue and things like that. But people aren't dumb. These wrestlers, they see what's going on. They know the landscape now. They know WWE has the money. If they want to keep you, if they want you that badly, you don't feel you're being paid, you're being undervalued. So you're going to start hearing more stories. Ooh, so-and-so is upset. So-and-so might leave. So-and-so might be in negotiations with AEW. But it's all bullshit. It's all just a way for a lot of these people to get more money out of WWE, to get what they think that they are worth. And I think that's where the Orton stuff is coming from. I really think that that's what this is ultimately all about. I don't think there's anything more to it. And look, it's smart. But these stories are not going to go away. This week alone, we heard stories about Randy Orton, The Undertaker, and The Usos. All possibly being interested. Yeah, The Undertaker going to All Elite Wrestling. I mean, give me a fucking break. You know what I mean? Like, I hear AEW also might be interested in digging up the corpse of Andre the Giant. That's what my sources are telling me that. I can't reveal them, of course, because I don't want to get them in trouble. But I hear they're interested in Andre's corpse, which would really piss off Vince McMahon. I mean, he might even have to change the name of the WrestleMania Battle Royal out of spite. PW Insider did say that the Usos deals are up in April. And they are negotiating right now with WWE. A lot more than Randy Orton. I think that there's a very good chance that they could leave and go somewhere else. I don't know exactly where their mind is at right now, if it's more a matter of, you know, money, if they're just unhappy, because the thing about the Usos is that they've done everything they could possibly do in WWE. They're multiple time tag team champions, wrestling the same two or three teams over and over and over and over again. Now they're going to have a shakeup in a few months. I could see them going from SmackDown to Raw. Is that going to make things any better? Okay, let's say you get the Usos away from the New Day, and you get the Usos away from the Bar. Look at the tag team division on Monday Night Raw. If I'm the Usos, I'm heading for the hills. Either that, or I'm saying put me in NXT. That would probably be better than Raw at this point. Maybe not for their checkbook, or their checking account, but you look at what they've done, and everybody they've worked with, and you say to yourself, you know what? I could see them saying, look, WWE, you're great. You've treated us well, but we're not feeling fulfilled. We want to go elsewhere and work with new people and wrestle new tag teams. So I do think that there's teeth to that story, and that's going to be something to watch. And if they leave, that's a big blow, because the Usos are probably the best team they have in that company right now. Tried and true, you could always rely on those guys to go out there and deliver a great match. They work well. They have good chemistry with a lot of different people. They're very good. They're still popular. And the tag team division right now, they need more teams, not less. They lose one of their best, if not their best team, and that tag team division is in shambles. So their deals are up in April. A lot can happen between now and then, but that's going to be, forget Orton, that's going to be something to watch. Is the situation with the Usos. But the Undertaker thing is comical to me, how that took off as some kind of a story, at least for a few days, it took off as some kind of story this week, because, you know, he apparently removed all of his references on his social media account, as though he did it himself. I mean, come on, whoever's running his accounts took down the mentions of WWE that had previously been there. All of a sudden, that must mean he's on the outs with WWE. All it is him and his people letting the world know that he's available to make appearances for events, conventions, you know, not other wrestling companies. And apparently at a very steep rate, too. Said to be $25,000 an hour if you want to book The Undertaker for your event. Depending on what kind of event it is. That's basically what I call the, if you're stupid enough to pay that kind of money, I'll do your show rate. That's kind of what you call that rate. like I never knew The Undertaker studied law. There are some lawyers that don't charge that kind of money. Actually, most lawyers probably don't charge that kind of money, unless you're at the very big firms. I didn't know Undertaker got his law degree. Randy Orton, though, in AEW, you know, hypothetically, if he went, would it be a big deal? Of course it would be. It'd be a huge coup for them. Forget the fact that people, sometimes some people are sick of Orton. Orton has been with WWE for almost 20 years. He's in that category with Cena and those guys. He's been there forever. If a guy like him were to ever leave and go to the other side, you don't think that would be a big deal? You don't think what it would represent to people would be a big deal? Of course it would. You know, he's still tight with Cody. Going back to their legacy days, I'm sure they'd love to work together again. Orton is at a stage of his career where he doesn't work a full-time schedule anymore, like he used to. Clearly, his family, his kids are very important to him. You see all the videos and photos of them he posts on Twitter and Instagram. He's done all there is to do, like the Usos. He's done all there is to do in WWE. Every championship that you could have, WrestleMania main event, Royal Rumbles, the guy has done it all. He's a guy who I think, frankly, could benefit from something like this if he was serious about it. New surroundings, new people to work with. But no, there was no contract offered to Randy Orton. And remember, you know, I would be open to hearing them out is very different than I'm leaving WWE. I don't think Orton is going anywhere. The fact is, though, this leads into a different story here. There are clearly a lot of very frustrated wrestlers under contract right now to WWE. We know about the Revival. We've heard the stories about Mike and Maria, even though Maria denied for her. She didn't deny it for her husband. She denied for her. But we've heard Mike and Maria Kanellis also at one point asked for their release, and they were denied. Some of the members of Sanity. Remember them? Yeah, they're still part of the SmackDown roster. Some of the members of Sanity have been on social media posting very frustrating tweets about, you know, them not being used. I don't know what's going on with Killian Dane. I saw him complaining on social media that Eric Young and Alexander Wolfe were used. There was a live event where they were being used, and he was sitting at home, and he couldn't understand why. Why are my teammates on the road? Why is my wife? His wife is Nikki Cross, or soon-to-be wife. I don't know if did they get engaged or married? I think they got engaged. I don't know. But anyway, my wife, Nikki Cross, she's on the road. My partners, they're on the road. Why am I at home? He couldn't understand why. Tyler Breeze. Just yesterday, Tyler Breeze tweeted, "One time I wrestled Jushin Thunder Liger in his only WWE match. What the hell happened?" And then when somebody pointed out that Breeze bought a Lamborghini and showed it off on Instagram, apparently, Breeze was very quick to point out, "Oh, I'm still rich, don't get me wrong. But there's still gas left in the tank." Ty Dillinger. I know these are lower card guys in a lot of cases, but still, Ty Dillinger is another one. When was the last time you saw him on TV? Now, you haven't heard a lot about him in recent weeks because he's been recovering from an injury, but even before he got hurt, when was the last time you saw Ty Dillinger doing anything of any great note on SmackDown television? There's one match I can vaguely remember a few months ago against Nakamura, but not a whole lot. He's not been doing a whole lot. And somebody asked him, he wins, by the way, for sad tweet. I'm giving sad tweet this week to Ty Dillinger. Somebody asked him, "Would you go back to NXT if it would be possible?" And Dillinger responded with one word: tried. Tried. There's your sad tweet for the week. Shelton Benjamin, who's been used so little, I legit keep forgetting that he is employed by WWE. I can't help but think of that story. I've told this story before. The whole, Curt Hawkins tells the story about the talent meeting many years ago. This is after Shelton left the company. And the Tarver, I just talked about this, but I always laugh when I think of Vince McMahon doing this all-talent meeting backstage, and Michael Tarver is asking him a question. And Vince just responds, "That's a great point, Shelton. That's a great question, Shelton." Even Vince didn't realize that Shelton Benjamin no longer worked for his company. I keep forgetting that he does. That's how little he's been used. He posted a GIF on his Twitter of a car spinning its wheels with the caption, "Current WWE status." Scott Hall posted a response to him saying, cash the checks, young man. Be happy you work for WWE. Just cash the checks. That's all it's about. Just cash the checks. Actually, you know, Shelton's 43 years old. Doesn't look like it, but Shelton Benjamin is 43 years old. He's no young man anymore. Not by WWE standards. Well, actually, you know what? I take that back. Actually, by WWE standards, you got Kurt Angle wrestling on Raw Monday night. You got Jeff Jarrett back on TV with the Road Dog. Yeah, you know what? He is a young man. By those standards, he is a young man. I take that back. But he's clearly frustrated. Hideo Itami asked for and seemingly was granted his release already due to creative frustrations. What a shock. And then there's Rusev and Lana. Rusev was a guest on Lillian Garcia's Chasing Glory podcast and talked about winning the United States Championship recently. This is what he said. He said, it meant a lot. It always does because it's the first championship I ever won. It kind of hurts me. And he's talking about losing the title a few weeks ago. It kind of hurts me because nobody cares about it. It feels like I'm the only one who cares about that title and I want to make it bigger. I wanted to make it what it was when I wrestled John Cena for it. But it seems like every time somebody else has it, nothing happens. Now that I've lost it, I know the title is probably going to get lost again. And I'm going to get lost again probably too. I do want to look my best because I want to be WWE champion. I want to be on top. I don't want to be forgotten. But that's what irks me. What irks me is that I do all of these things. Because he was talking about how he really worked to drop weight and all these things to make himself look better. He says, I do all of these things, but nothing changes. And that's where the frustration comes. I'm trying to catch Vince's eye with this or that. We go, we pitch, we talk. It just never comes to anything. It was last year around WrestleMania. And before that, when Rusev Day started and everything. And I thought it was my time. And I keep pushing for it to be my time, and I talk to everybody, but nobody wants to do anything. I don't know what is holding me back, to be honest. I really, really don't. This poor bastard. I just picture him out on the ledge about to jump. I'm trying to talk him into coming back inside. But the frustration is real. The fact is, they built this guy up for the purposes, if we're being perfectly honest here, when they built up Rusev all those years ago, and we're going on, what, 4 years now, probably. The only reason they built him up in the first place was for the purposes of jobbing him out to John Cena at WrestleMania. That was their only real plan for him. We'll keep him undefeated. We'll put the U.S. title on him. Oh, this is great. The guy rode a fucking tank out to the ring at WrestleMania. They can never take that away from him, but why do you think they did that? So he could lose to John Cena. And after that, is it any wonder that there just didn't seem to be any kind of backup plan or fallback plan or any other plans even 6 months or a year later? The whole Rusev Day thing was dumb luck. The company didn't plan that. It took them a while to even embrace it. Through dumb luck, they fell into this wave of popularity last year, or the year before, with Rusev. But that was his only purpose initially when he came up. And when that happened, when he lost to Cena, that was it. The story arc is over. We got what we wanted. He was done after that. He's not done much of anything since, aside from the Rusev Day stuff. But there's other problems here too when it comes to Rusev. And I want to just focus on him for a bit here because he is a talented guy. He can be contributing in a bigger way than he is now. There's problems here though. For one, he's foreign. He wasn't born in this country. And we all know what, and I don't give a shit, but we all know what Vince McMahon thinks of you if you're foreign, right? Just go back and watch the Stone Cold podcast that he did with Steve Austin and his comments about Cesaro. Another one who has all the tools to be champion one day. If they really wanted to put their effort behind him, got two world titles for Christ, or oh, I'm sorry, universal title. You got two top titles on two different brands. And you have a guy like Cesaro who's just a perennial tag team wrestler. Not because he can't be a single star, because they don't see him that way. And why don't they see him that way? Because you've got this guy in Vince McMahon who goes on this podcast and says, I just don't understand. I just don't understand. I don't think he's connecting with the audience. He's foreign. So I guess he doesn't have the tools to be the WWE champion one day because he's foreign. I guess he can't connect with the audience. You look at the list of WWE champions that we've had over the years, and I know a lot of you are probably going to be screaming at your phone or computer or whatever after this, saying, yes, and how about the lack of African-American WWE champions too? Absolutely. Absolutely. You absolutely are right about that too. But you look at the list of champions in the last 8 or 9 years. I believe Alberto Del Rio, who was born in Mexico, and Sheamus, who was born in Ireland, were the only foreign-born men to hold the WWE title. They all speak English. You can understand them just fine. Language is not an issue for Rusev. He's got an accent, but so what? But if you don't think that doesn't play into their thinking, the whole foreign thing, if you think I'm joking, or you think, oh, you're reaching, if you think that's the case, you haven't been paying very close attention. You must be new here. So that's number one. Number two, they have too many people under contract and they don't know what to do with all of them. And three, half the time, they simply don't know how best to use the people that they have, period. Half the time, they just don't know what to do. Rusev says, I want to be WWE champion. Well, get in line. So does everybody else. He's not the only one. Everybody wants to be the champion. But you can't deny that the guy has the tools to be the champion if they ever wanted to give him the ball. They had the chance last year. There was a match. What was that July pay-per-view? There was a pay-per-view match. It was a main event, but it was AJ Styles against Rusev for the WWE title. If ever they were going to give Rusev even just a month, put the title on him and let's just see how he does. I feel like that was his opportunity. And it didn't happen, and I don't think it's ever going to happen. But that was as close as I think he really came to, if they really wanted to, put the title on him and just, as a heel or a babyface or whatever, let him run with it and see how he does. He doesn't have a lot of, you know, fancy matches on his resume like Daniel Bryan or like AJ Styles, but he can work, he can talk, he can be very entertaining on the microphone. I don't mean doing the old Rusev crush, Machka, like evil heel foreigner stuff. But just being his actual self, he's a very entertaining, very charismatic guy. And physically, like he said in the interview, he's in the best shape of his life. But you can understand his frustration. He just doesn't know what else he can do. He's a guy who simply is not a priority to them. They see him as a mid-card for life. And the reality is, I don't know when his deal is up. But he's a guy who I could absolutely see going somewhere else to prove something to people. He strikes me as somebody who would leave. He would have this feeling in the pit of his stomach, I got to prove something to Vince McMahon. I got to show him what he missed out on. Take like Drew McIntyre, take whatever rage and frustration you have and throw it back in their face and say, I'm going to show them. They're going to be begging to have me back. And in a few years, he'll be the guy who goes back to WWE, a bigger star than he was when he left. I could see that in Rusev. Drew McIntyre did that. Alberto Del Rio did it when he left and came back. He deserves better. That doesn't mean he has to be WWE champion, but he definitely deserves better than the hand that he's being dealt right now. They have a lot of competition for that top spot. Not everybody can be the champion. But they could surely be doing more with him. And he may be the beneficiary of this superstar shakeup that they're doing in April. And I'll talk about that when I get to Raw here in a couple of minutes. This is a potential Hall of Fame spoiler. So a warning for those of you who do not want to know anything about the Hall of Fame inductees or possible inductees until WWE makes it official, which they might this week. But just a word of warning, you might want to skip ahead by about 10 or 15 minutes or so. Mike Johnson of PW Insider broke the news, which has yet to be confirmed by WWE, but also has not been denied, that the original Hart Foundation, Bret the Hitman Hart, Jim the Anvil Neidhart, and the Mouth of the South, Jimmy Hart. By the way, Jim Neidhart would have turned 64 years old this week, on Friday, in fact. But they will all be inducted into the WWE Hall of Fame at the Barclays Center in Brooklyn the night before WrestleMania. Originally, the Hall of Fame was going to be that Friday night before WrestleMania. WWE swapped it with the NXT show because the Ring of Honor New Japan show is happening in Madison Square Garden that night. And they just didn't want to compete. And they wanted the fans, I guess, to be able to go to both shows. And so they swapped them out. But Johnson said, and of course, the Hall of Fame is competing with the ROH New Japan show, but the Hall of Fame is what it is. Johnson says that a contingent of Hart family members will be making the trip to New York City to attend the ceremony, so clearly they're already discussing their travel plans with people, which is, I guess, maybe, I don't know if that's maybe the reason why this news leaked. This is not the 1997 stable version of the Hart Foundation, so it does not include Owen Hart, it does not include the British Bulldog, and it does not include Brian Pillman, all of whom deserve induction at some point into the Hall of Fame. Now, they could have inducted them as a group and just not acknowledged Owen. That just wouldn't feel right. I mean, I saw some people suggesting that there's certain kind of underhanded ways you could do it, I guess, where he, you know, you're inducting Owen, but not loudly inducting Owen. It just, it wouldn't feel right to me. I just, as a fan, I feel like it just would not be right. I would hate to see some kind of silent induction for Owen Hart. They have these legacy inductees. It may just get to a point where one day they have Owen Hart as a legacy inductee. The legacy inductees are usually older stars who have since passed away, not necessarily very big names or names that the current audience would be familiar with. And maybe they didn't even do a lot in WWE, but they were big names in the business. And they have this group of, I don't know, maybe five or six legacy inductees every year. They just sort of announce them. It may get to a point at some point where Owen Hart is a legacy inductee, and I think that would be pretty shitty too, but it's a tough spot for them to be in. If he's going to go in, I think he needs to be acknowledged the right way. And you can't do a Hart Foundation group induction without, you know, including tons of footage of him in the induction video. I'm sure Martha Hart would pitch a fit. She'd put a press release out about the whole thing, and that just is not the kind of publicity that this company is looking for. I think this all but eliminates the possibility of the Hart Foundation ever going in as a faction into the Hall of Fame, because do they really want to put Bret Hart in the Hall of Fame three times? I mean, look, I'm the biggest Bret Hart fan in the world. I've said many times, I mean, he's my all-time favorite. They could put him in the Hall of Fame five times for all I care. But WWE is not putting Bret Hart in the Hall of Fame three different times. That just sounds ridiculous. This is going to make his second induction into the Hall. He was first inducted in 2006. Same for Jimmy Hart. Jimmy Hart was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2005, and he, I believe, becomes the first manager to get a second induction. The Anvil was never inducted. And, you know, this really pisses me the hell off, because here we are yet again with a case of too little, too late. Neidhart just passed away last year, which is probably the only reason he is even going into the Hall of Fame this year. We've seen this before. We saw it with Randy Savage. They waited so long, and finally, they put him in, only after he's dead. A year ago, in January, there was a note in the Observer about Bret Hart really hoping that WWE would put the Hart Foundation into the Hall of Fame last year in New Orleans, because Neidhart was battling very serious health issues. We've since come to find out that he had early onset Alzheimer's disease and maybe other ailments as well. So he was having some pretty serious health issues at the time. And Bret was worried that if they didn't induct him then, he might not be able to enjoy it. He might not be able to come on stage and accept the honor. And that it really would mean a lot to him. Well, now he's dead. The Hart Foundation should have been in years ago. Look at Vader. Look at Vader. In 2016, Vader went on Twitter and said he had two heart doctors tell him that he had 2 years left to live. Less than 2 years. Not even 2 years. Less than 2 years left to live. A little less than 2 years later, he's dead. He had said, I'm hoping that I, you know, have the one last chance to make an appearance in front of the fans, on stage. They had two chances in that time to induct him into the Hall of Fame, and they didn't do it. He wasn't persona non grata in the company. He made cameos. He was on Table for Three on the network. He was working with them in different ways. They didn't put him in. You mean to tell me that Big Van Vader doesn't belong in the Hall of Fame? Again, all of these things you would think, well, here's why they didn't want him to go in. No. Vader's a big name. He worked for them as well as not just Japan and not just WCW. And again, he was doing other things for the company. He wasn't, you know, excommunicated from the company in some way. Now, he'll still end up going into the Hall of Fame at some point. And now his son can accept on his behalf because he's dead and he's not there to do it himself. I actually thought he was one of the more entertaining parts of the Hall of Fame a few years ago when he inducted Stan Hansen. He did the whole bit with the eye and the people laughed. He was actually on stage inducting Stan, but that should have been him on stage accepting his own award. And now he can't do that. We've seen this far too many times and it sucks. Obviously, it would make sense for his daughter, Jim's daughter, Natty, to be the one to induct the Hart Foundation. Last year, she said it would be an honor for her to do so. I thought you would have her on stage with Brett and Jimmy to accept, but I guess it makes more sense for her to do the induction and just let Bret Hart and Jimmy Hart be the ones to accept on all three of their behalf. The Hart Foundation is my second favorite tag team of all time, behind Demolition. Another team that's not in the Hall of Fame but should be. You can tell I grew up a WWF fan in the 80s by these names, right? If I grew up an NWA fan in the Carolinas, I would give you a whole other list of names. But those are my two favorite all-time tag teams. And, you know, with Demolition, that concussion suit that they signed on to, they were hardly the only ones who signed on to that lawsuit. That lawsuit was thrown out. That's over. You know, Bill Eadie, Axe, is 71 years old. What the hell are they waiting for? Bret Hart, Jim Neidhart, they came to WWF after Vince bought Stampede Wrestling from Stu Hart. It was actually Stu's request as part of the deal that they made. I want you to bring in some of my family members. I want you to bring in my son. I want you to bring in my son-in-law. Bret was not a good promo back then. Some people would say even in his later years, Bret was not a good promo. Those people would be factually incorrect, but you're entitled to your opinion. I still think you are factually incorrect. Bret Hart in 97? You're going to call him a bad promo? You don't know what the fuck you're talking about. But in his early years, absolutely. Bret was actually very cringeworthy on some of his promos. He's admitted he wasn't comfortable. He would wear the shades. You couldn't see his eyes, you know, darting around in nervousness like he did in some of those other earlier promos that he used to do without the glasses. But it was the Anvil who sort of picked up the slack on promos and really, you know, showed a lot of that personality that maybe Bret didn't have or Bret wasn't showing. But Bret absolutely got better as the years went on. He was never the best promo in the world, but you cannot objectively say that Bret Hart was a shitty promo or Bret Hart didn't know how to talk on the microphone. If you watch his work towards the end of his run in WWE, and frankly, even some of the stuff he did in WCW, I still howl when I go back and I watch the segment with him and Mean Gene, when he was talking, you know, he was talking about psychosis, and he was talking about El Dandy, and he was botching their names, and Bret had it in him. He doesn't get enough credit for it, but he absolutely had it in him, and he was a good promo there by the end. Very good promo, actually. But they held the tag team titles twice. The first time they beat the British Bulldogs, this was in 87. The matches those two teams had were just classics. They really carried a lot of those old WWF shows when they were working together. They were the workhorses. Those two teams were the workhorses on those shows. The match they had where they actually won the tag team belts the first time was really no good at all. That was largely because of Dynamite's injury. They took Dynamite out right at the start. He didn't do anything. He didn't take any bumps. His back was just totally thrashed. He had no business even being out there at that point. But they won their second tag team title from Demolition in a 2 out of 3 falls match at SummerSlam back in 1990. My favorite of all the Hart Foundation matches I've ever seen. A few months later, they dropped the belts to the Rockers at a TV taping. But the rope broke during the match. And the whole thing kind of fell apart. I can remember actually when in later years they finally released the footage, because that match was supposed to air on television and they opted not to ever air it. But it's since been released on certain DVDs and such, and I can remember the Anvil loudly shouting "fuck" a whole bunch of times during that match after the rope broke. He was not a happy camper when that happened. But like I said, it never did air on TV. The Rockers actually did defend the tag team titles at least once, but WWF for whatever reason decided not to air the title change, and they just gave the belts back to the Hart Foundation. So their reign has never officially been acknowledged for Michaels and Jannetty. But instead, they dropped the belts to the Nasty Boys at WrestleMania 7. Shortly after that, Brett launched his singles career. At SummerSlam that year, he won the IC title from Mr. Perfect. Now, they tried Anvil out as an announcer on Wrestling Challenge for a while. I guess that didn't work out because it was very short-lived. But then they paired him off with Owen Hart. They were going to try to recreate the magic of the Hart Foundation. They called them the New Foundation. It's like the New Coke. This worked out about as well as New Coke did. That only lasted a few months. He got fired. Came back in 94. They linked him back up with Owen, this time as heels. This was after Owen won the King of the Ring. Then he got fired again. This time for he was no-showing event, so they fired him. He came back again, this time as the infamous masked wrestler. Who? That was his name. Who? In 90s, he wasn't dressed up as an owl. People just didn't know who he was, even though it was patently obvious who it was under the mask. I mean, this guy, he's got a pretty noticeable figure and the beard and everything else. But yeah, they put him under a mask and they called him Who. And he was a job guy on Superstars for a while. This is back in 96. Who, of course, is a play off the famous Abbott and Costello Who's on First routine, which is still the greatest comedy routine of all time. So that only lasted a few months. Then he came back the year later, in 97, as part of the Hart Foundation faction. And he was part of the one of the greatest matches, really, in company history. That big 10-man tag at the Canadian Stampede pay-per-view. After the Montreal Screwjob, he left a few weeks later. They let him out of his contract. He went to WCW. He did some tag team matches with the Bulldog. Never really went anywhere. He was gone that same year. He ended up in WCW in 98, in January, I think. By September, he was gone. And that was really it. That was the end of him as a full-time performer. He wrestled indies from that point on. He got into some trouble with pills and whatever else. You know, he had his issues. But in recent years, I know he was on Total Divas with Natty, had cameos on that show. And when I think of tag team wrestling, I immediately think of the Hart Foundation. I immediately think of the British Bulldogs. I think of Demolition. I think of LOD. I think of the Steiner Brothers. Certain names, certain teams just jump out at you. For me, it's those names. And then even in later years, you know, Edge and Christian and the Hardys and the Dudleys kind of brought this renewed focus back to tag team wrestling that had been lost for a while. So those are the names of the teams that I think about when I think of tag team wrestling. But you cannot have a WWE Hall of Fame without having the Hitmen and the Anvil in there together. I just wish it would have happened a lot sooner. WWE released its fourth quarter earnings this week, and they achieved record revenue, over $930 million in revenue for 2018, which is just a ridiculous sum of money. Not bad considering that their television ratings and their live event attendance and their live event revenue are all down and continue to decline. It's all the more clear now just how important those new TV deals are and their deal with Saudi Arabia and why they were very vehemently against canceling that deal last year with all that controversy when it was going on. That Super Showdown show in Australia in October also apparently did very well for them, so we can probably expect to see more of those international-type super shows in the future. But when you dig into the numbers and you try to estimate just how much that Saudi deal accounts for the uptick in the money that they made, well, let's just say that I can't wait for the return of John Cena in May. For Sweet Saudi Money 3, You Can't See Me. On the investor conference call, Vince McMahon said this. He said, "Athletes are not cartoons and people get hurt." In talking about the absence of Roman Reigns, and John Cena now being a part-time performer. He ran through this laundry list of injuries. He was talking about guys from the top to the very bottom of the card, all these people being out hurt over the last several months. And he said it's uncommon for them to have so many injuries at once like that. So much for the so-called WWE safe style, by the way. But he said that it's one of the reasons that the television ratings and the live event attendance have dropped. I'm glad he said one of, because I was going to go off. when I reread it and he said one of, I said, okay, you can justify that. But to blame it all on the injuries, though, or blame the fact that Roman Reigns has not been on television, does not account for the fact that your television ratings, let's focus on TV ratings in particular, and you'll have people who say, oh, the ratings don't matter as much, the ratings don't matter as much. Okay, but let's talk about the TV ratings for a second, okay? They have been in decline for years now. So the fact that Roman Reigns has been on television for, what, 3 months? 4 months? John Cena has been part-time now for, what, a year? Maybe a little more than a year? You cannot attribute these declines solely to Roman Reigns. Or solely to the fact that all these people have been hurt. That's why these things are down. This is not a 2018 thing. It was a 2017 thing. Before that, it was a 2016 thing. Before that, it was a 2015 thing. You see where I'm going with this? Oh, but the ratings were up after the Royal Rumble. The ratings were up after the Rumble. Yes, but they were down from where they were a year ago after the Royal Rumble. This is what some people don't understand. The night after the Royal Rumble last year, that Raw show did 3.3 million viewers, which is down from previous years. But let's focus on the last two. 3.3 million viewers. The night after the Royal Rumble this year, 2.7 million. You can't just explain this stuff away by crying about injuries. As though if we get all of these names back at the same time, healthy and ready to go, the television is going to be so much better. And the numbers are going to just soar back up to where they used to be. That's not how this works. But I wanted to share this little gem with you from WWE's annual report to the SEC as it relates to one of the risk factors that the company faces, that being the sudden, unexpected loss of Vince McMahon. This is what the note said. In addition to serving as chairman of the board of directors and chief executive officer, Mr. McMahon leads the creative team that develops the storylines and the characters for our programming, including our television, WWE Network, and other programming, as well as live events. From time to time, Mr. McMahon has also been an important member of our cast of performers. The loss of Mr. McMahon, due to unexpected retirement, disability, death, or other unexpected termination for any reason, could have a material adverse effect on our ability to create popular characters and creative storylines, or could otherwise adversely affect our operating results. There you have it. If Vince croaks, who will create all of this compelling television that we see on TV every Monday night? They may as well wave the white flag right now. May have a material adverse effect on our ability to create creative storylines. Isn't there some kind of law against lying to the SEC? I want to talk a little bit about Raw here. Some of the important things from last Monday. Raw was in Portland, Oregon. They have announced an international superstar shakeup for the April 15th episode of Monday Night Raw and the April 16th episode of SmackDown Live. That is the week after WrestleMania 35. International, I assume, is just a reference to where they're going to be for the shows that week, which is the Bell Center, both nights in Montreal, Quebec, Canada. A fine place, by the way, I think, for Kevin Owens or Sami Zayn to return, if not both, to return to television if they don't plan to bring either of them back before WrestleMania. And there's still a chance, you know, Owens could be back before Mania, but if they held off on them or if they weren't ready yet, you wait until after WrestleMania And I think that would be a great time to bring both of them back. More importantly, to keep them apart on different shows. One on Raw, one on SmackDown. These two guys have been like Siamese twins since they came up from NXT. They have been inseparable. Even when Owens, I think, was moved from Raw to SmackDown, Sammy followed him. Like the ex-girlfriend from hell. These two have followed each other everywhere they have gone. It is time for them to go their separate ways and let them do their own thing. As far as shake-up moves, look, it's very early. I'm going to wait until we get closer and maybe I'll do like a mock draft and give a whole list of where I think different people should go. Off the top of my head, you know, I mentioned Rusev earlier. I think that he would benefit from a change in scenery, maybe going from SmackDown to Raw. I think Finn Balor from Raw to SmackDown is a gimme. The Usos, moving them from SmackDown to Raw. I mean, those to me would be some obvious moves. And then, of course, calling up new names from NXT. Fox is going to be watching. And they're going to want some more big names on that show before it moves to Fox in the fall. So that's something to keep in mind, too. Finn Balor to SmackDown is great. But there's got to be another, at least one other big name, I think. And it might well be a Ronda Rousey, assuming Rousey doesn't disappear after WrestleMania, which it certainly sounds like she might. But a Rousey or a Brock Lesnar, I mean, someone of that nature, I think, is going to have to go over to SmackDown. I think AJ Styles going from SmackDown to Raw is another move that would probably make sense. AJ's another one who I feel, yeah, it's kind of his show in a way these days, but he's done a lot of, you know, what you would hope for him to do and faced all the key people, except maybe Orton. He hasn't had a proper program yet with Randy Orton. But he has with Brian. He has with Joe Nakamura, who obviously has moved down the card. So we'll see. We'll see what happens. When we get closer, though, we'll talk more about these moves. I think it is something that is desperately needed right now. But you got to do more than just reshuffle the deck. I mean, they have other issues in terms of what they do with their talent that they're going to have to address. The Becky stuff. Becky Lynch. She was confronted by Stephanie McMahon. This could have gone wrong so many different ways. Thankfully, they did the right thing in the end, which I said last week. I said, for all the reservations I have, I think in the end, call me crazy, I think they'll do the right thing. And watching this, they did not have Stephanie slap Becky and Becky just stood there and took it or anything like that. The whole storyline is they know her knee is hurt. They want her to be evaluated by a WWE doctor. Becky doesn't want a Z-Pack. And so here we are now at a standstill. She does not want to see the doctor. And until such time that she allows them to have the doctor evaluate her, she is suspended. And I guess, you know, her WrestleMania title opportunity is now in jeopardy. So that's the storyline here. Now look, the Becky stuff, I think, is unique. Not in that we've never seen this type of story before, we have. But it's been with men. Men like Steve Austin, men like CM Punk, Daniel Bryan, right? These anti-authority figures. We've never seen this before with one of the women in WWE. They've never had that one female performer who they were going to put in this kind of similar role, who had the crowd support, had the fan support behind her, and just build this whole story around her. That's what makes this unique. So it may not be an original concept, but it's the first time we've seen a female play that part and go on, hopefully, to headline WrestleMania. And like Daniel Bryan, she was never supposed to be in this role. If you think that the original idea, going back to last year, was for Becky Lynch to headline WrestleMania, to be part of the first ever women's WrestleMania main event and wrestle Ronda Rousey and not Charlotte Flair, you are so wrong, it's not even funny. I mean, everybody pretty much, I would think, knows that the idea had to have been that if we're going to do this, it's got to be Charlotte and Ronda. But then plans sometimes get blown up. Things happen. People catch fire. People get hurt. Shit happens. So here we are again. Daniel Bryan got over in a way they didn't expect. Becky Lynch got over in a way they didn't expect. Becky Lynch has been on the roster for a few years now. Who would have known that she would suddenly catch fire the way that she has? You can't predict these. Like when something goes viral, you can't predict it. Becky went viral. Now, unfortunately for her, when things go viral, they don't stay viral and popular forever. So as time goes on here, They're going to have to find ways to keep the crowd engaged, not have people turn on her. There is the possibility that if she goes all the way to WrestleMania and she beats Ronda Rousey and she wins the Raw Women's Championship, that after WrestleMania, after the story has peaked, that it's all going to be down from there. And it won't be long before these fickle fans turn on Becky Lynch. I expect it. I don't think it's a matter of if, it's a matter of when. How long can she sustain this popularity? And when the time is right, you could turn her heel. But now is obviously not the time to do that. But that's what happened with her. This wasn't something that was planned or scripted, or, hey, we got this great idea to get Becky Lynch over, you know, even more than our beloved Charlotte as the number one female performer. It just happened. The thing that I think is kind of funny to go back and look at now, in retrospect, and this is not an excuse for what Nia Jax did to her, but Nia Jax punching her in the face and injuring her and having to cancel that Survivor Series match between Ronda and Becky was the best thing that could have happened to this woman. The best thing that could have happened in the career of Becky Lynch, as it turned out, was getting punched in the face by Nia Jax. If we get Rousey versus Lynch at Survivor Series as planned, there's no way that we're talking about it as a WrestleMania main event. Not one-on-one, anyway. It's Rousey versus Charlotte, and maybe Becky finds her way into it. Instead, it's Ronda versus Becky, and maybe Charlotte finds her way into it. Actually, Charlotte probably finds her way into it. Most likely finds her way into it. But that's not a guarantee. WWE announced, after Becky attacked Stephanie on Raw, tried to break her arm, and was suspended, she appeared on SmackDown on Tuesday night and went nose to beak with Triple H. And Triple H said the same thing. You got to get cleared. You're suspended until you let our doctors evaluate you. And Becky had some unkind words for him. And he went into her and said, you know, you're basically tried to just tear her apart verbally. And talk about how I think you're scared. I don't think you're really hurt. I think you're afraid to step in there with Ronda Rousey and you're faking this injury and all this other stuff. And finally, Becky just hauled off and she slapped him in the face. But now, the invitation has been extended to the suspended Becky Lynch for her, in the wake of her actions this past week, to appear on Raw this Monday night. I said this on Twitter. I said, boy, this lasted about as long as Kevin Owens quitting. When he sat in the ring that one week on Raw and said, I quit, and he walked away, he was back the very next week. Actually, this is even worse, because she was suspended on Monday, but yet was back on Tuesday. Although, to be fair, she sort of crashed Raw. So, you don't really have any control over it if somebody crashes the party. In this case, they're openly extending an invitation to her to come to Monday Night Raw a week after she was suspended. And you'll have people who say, well, you know, she could still be suspended. She's just not allowed to wrestle. I don't know. Call me crazy, but when somebody is suspended, I expect to not see them on television. So I just think it's kind of foolish. If you were going to do the suspension thing, which I thought was fine to get her off TV for a few weeks, that you would invite her back so quickly. I assume it's all part of some kind of nefarious McMahon plan. They're going to attack Becky. And look, you're going to have people, if Becky gets laid out this week, who are going to be up. See, look what they're doing. They're going to screw this up. They're laying her out. They're making her look weak. It won't bother me as much, depending on how they do it, because she's got to, at some point, lay down for somebody. She's got to get beaten down. There's got to be some kind of way to get sympathy on her. She is acting, you know, kind of very heelish in some ways. So if they all gang up on her and beat her down, and then she ends up, you know, coming back and getting revenge on the McMahons at some point, that's fine. But anyway, that's the little storyline twist on what they're doing with Becky Lynch. I still expect that at Elimination Chamber and or Fastlane, we're going to get a match or two with Becky and Charlotte. And that last match, you know, I laid this out last week or a couple weeks ago. That last match, let's say at Fastlane next month, the stipulation needs to be that if Charlotte wins, she gets added to the WrestleMania main event, not that she gets Becky's spot. Because I think it would be more believable for people to think that, okay, Charlotte's clearly going to win because Becky gets to keep her shot, but they really want Charlotte in that match. Oh, of course Charlotte's going to win, but then she doesn't. You would almost be swerving people, because I think people are pretty convinced at this point that Charlotte's going to find her way into that match in some way. We had Elias and Jeff Jarrett. So, look, I was one of the... I feel like I'm one of the few people who actually stood up for that segment a couple weeks ago and said, I enjoyed it. I thought it was fun. When they had Jeff Jarrett come out on Raw on the Road Dog, and they were singing With My Baby Tonight, and Elias laid them both out with a guitar. I just thought, you know what, this was a fun segment. But then they went and they announced that Jeff Jarrett was returning to Raw to wrestle for the first time in 20 years, and he was going to wrestle Elias, and he was bringing Road Dog with him. And then I'm watching the show on Monday night, and I see the Road Dog out there, and he's doing his old shtick, and he's, we're going to do that Shiznit doggy style, and he's gyrating a 50-year-old Road Dog here, and I'm like, this is sad. You know what I mean? Jeff Jarrett, he introduces Jeff Jarrett. Jarrett comes out like it's 1995 all over again. The greatest singer, the greatest entertainer, the greatest wrestler. It's like I fell into the worst time warp imaginable. Of all the years in WWE history to go back to, you took me back to 1995. The one year where I came as close as I have ever been up to now as a fan to just quitting altogether. That's how awful things were at the beginning of that year. I'm watching matches on TV with the fucking Blue Brothers. And Freddie Joe Floyd and T.L. Hopper. Fuck you. They take me back to 1995 with this shit. They take something that was fun as a one-week thing and they just drive it into the ground. So they had a match. It was boring. There was really... I don't know what they're... With Elias, like I said, there's concern behind the scenes. Oh, Elias, he's not connecting with audiences outside of WWE. I can't imagine why. I'm sure a feud with Jeff Jarrett will just cure those ills. Oh, yeah. That'll do him a world of good. At least he won. At least he won. He hit his move, the drift away. He pinned him. Although, in the end, he was laid out. And Jarrett and Road Dogg were standing tall. Jarrett couldn't even break the guitar over his back. He hit him with it, but it didn't break. They were the ones walking out, not Elias. So I still quite don't understand what this accomplished. They had a moment of bliss with EC3. He's still a mute. He's lost his vocal cords. It's very sad. Dean Ambrose interrupted. He was back as a babyface, it felt like, on this show. I don't think he was meant to be a babyface, but that's sure how he came off. People were laughing at all of his jokes. What's your name? Oh, you're EC3. What happened to EC1 and EC2? And everybody laughed. You know, it's funny about Ambrose. I think it was Meltzer who said the plan at one point last year, before Roman got sick again, had been for the WrestleMania main event, or one of the top matches at WrestleMania, to be Roman Reigns, I assume for the Universal title, against Dean Ambrose. Against what I assume would have been a heel Dean Ambrose. Ambrose was going to turn heel, maybe not as quickly as he did. But I'm like, I think about that, I'm like, wow, that's... The plan for WrestleMania had been Roman against Dean, and now you look at what they're doing with him here. It's like, no wonder the guy's leaving. Is it any wonder why he wants to get the hell out of this company? So anyway, they had a short match. EC3 won with a jackknife roll-up. You know, look, they're going to use Ambrose to try to get other people over. I have no idea what this really accomplished for EC3. When you get a fluke win like that, I mean, I guess they'll make it out to be a really big deal. It wasn't a long, really competitive match or anything. Maybe they'll have a rematch on Monday. But this is how they're going to use Ambrose on the way out. In fact, they have a local ad. You've all seen it, I'm sure, by now. They're having a show. I think it's later this month in Jonesboro, Arkansas. And they're promoting an intergender special attraction between Dean Ambrose and Nia Jax. I said on Twitter, I said, you know, Vince's grand plan is to send Nia the Enforcer in there to hurt Dean. And that way he can freeze his contract and stop him from leaving, just like he did with Rey Mysterio a few years ago. And then watch, on May 26th, all of a sudden, they'll unfreeze his contract. You know, if they want to have the intergender thing with Dean and Nia, I have no idea, by the way, if they're going to carry this into WrestleMania. Maybe this is a little experiment. Maybe this is a test run. And they will do this match at Fastlane. They will do it at WrestleMania. I'm okay with it in that it's something high profile enough, I guess, for Ambrose to be doing. I mean, I can't think of anybody else on that roster right now that Ambrose could suddenly enter into a feud with at random. And that includes EC3. That would really excite me. Do I want to see Nia Jax there beating Dean Ambrose? No. But it's a unique match. And I don't put any stock in what they do with Dean. From here on out, he's in a lame duck period with WWE right now. They're going to do everything in their power to bury this guy. They're not going to do anything with him. It's like Jericho. They kind of did the same thing with Jericho towards the end of his WCW run when they knew he was leaving. I don't remember if they were just jobbing him out every week, but they sure as shit weren't doing anything with him. And when he came to WWE, it was a fresh start, and he was a big star on his very first night. Whatever Ambrose is going to do, wherever he's going to go, what WWE does with him between now and then is irrelevant. But, you know, to get upset about, oh, they're going to bury him, they're going to do this and that, well, what do you expect? He still works for them. I don't think they're going to just bench him. They're going to want him to work. They're going to want to get something out of him. If this is their test to see how the fans react to intergender matches, this could be the first of many that they start doing. They figure, okay, you know, Dean's leaving, so we'll use him. We'll put him in there with Nia. We'll see how it does. Let's put it on this house show. Let's see if it draws. It's unique enough. We haven't seen it in so many years in WWE. You know, maybe they'll actually sell tickets with it. They're hosting a 70th birthday party on Raw for Ric Flair in 2 weeks in Atlanta. Someone call Gloria Allred. This will not end well. They had Kurt Angle on this show. He came out to cut a promo, and he was teasing retirement, clearly, before he was interrupted by Baron Corbin, and then Drew McIntyre, and they were threatening to attack when Braun Strowman showed up, and that led to a tag team match later on in the show that ended in a disqualification. But it ended with Strowman slamming both Corbin and McIntyre onto the steel steps that had been brought into the ring. Actually, the DQ in this match was pretty fucking terrible because they have this tag team match, right, that they set up earlier in the show. And it's one thing to have somebody, you know, use a weapon or do something like, you know, attack the referee and get disqualified. But what they did here was Strowman came into the ring. I guess he wasn't the legal man. And he was going to attack Baron Corbin. Baron Corbin said, you can't because you'll be disqualified. You're not the legal man. Well, Strowman didn't give a crap and he attacked him anyway. And that led to the disqualification. Absolutely dreadful. Absolutely positively dreadful. Now, apparently they're either changing or suddenly they're going to enforce these rules on WWE television where you're only allowed one save in a tag team match. I think that's what's going on here. I saw someone from the Revival post something about these tag team rules and all this other stuff. They go through these phases where all of a sudden the rules matter until 2 weeks later when they don't. They've pulled this shit with instant replay before. They get a bug up their ass about doing something, and 2-3 weeks later, it's back to the, you know, back to the same old, same old. It's such an insult to the audience, and what a fucking terrible finish to this match. But the show ended with the babyfaces celebrating. You know, Kurt Angle, he's got to get one last WrestleMania match out of this, I think. But I'm just not sure that I care anymore as far as who it is, or like when it comes to who. I don't really, it's hard to care. It's hard to get excited about it. I just don't see any really exciting options for him. SmackDown was from Everett, Washington on Tuesday. I already talked earlier about the Becky stuff. She had come out of the crowd, even though she was suspended. She interrupted Charlotte. And Becky had her moment with Triple H, where she stood there and listened and listened and listened like a good girl. She let him speak uninterrupted. And then eventually she hauled off and slapped him across the face. And now she'll be on Raw this Monday night. I'm sure that will not end well for her. Randy Orton and Mustafa Ali had a match that turned into a pretty good little match. Not so much for Ali. I'll tell you why in a second. But the finish was awesome. Ali was going for the 054. And as he's standing on the ropes, getting ready to jump off for the 054, Randy Orton comes over. He grabs Ali by the leg. And he yanks him off the ropes. And as he yanks Ali off the ropes, he catches him in midair with an RKO. One of the best RKOs he's ever done. I won't say the best. I still think, if I think back in the annals of all the great RKOs I've seen Randy Orton do, the Evan Bourne one is up there. I probably would do Evan Bourne at number 2. And the WrestleMania one with Rollins at WrestleMania 31. I think that one probably is my favorite. He's had some great ones. This one, I think you got to put this one on the list. Maybe not top five, definitely top 10, though. Still think back to that SmackDown episode after Christian won the World Heavyweight title. Actually, I think it was 2 days later on television. And Christian came off the ropes and got caught with the RKO. And boy, I mean, the crowd went crazy and everything, but boy, were there a lot of very angry people. I think I might have been one of them. I'd have to go back and listen to that episode. That was in 2011. But anyway, great RKO, great finish to a match where Ali got hurt. Orton, as he was doing his Garvin stomp on all the different parts of Ali's anatomy, stepped on his face, on his, easy for me to say, face. He stepped on his face. Oh my God. What's wrong with me? He stepped on his face. Yes, his face. He did some damage. He gave him a really wicked black eye. And connected a little too much. I can't recall, before everybody gets on me, whoa, you gotta hold him to the same standard as Nia Jax and Brie Bella. I can't recall any stories of Randy Orton injuring anybody or being, you know, reckless in the past. I'm sure somebody will correct me if I'm wrong. I know that he did punt Vince McMahon into oblivion that one time on TV, but Vince told him to lay it in, and so he laid it in. But still, you're stomping on the guy's face like that. You got to be more careful. I mean, you're literally stomping down on someone's face. His eye looked really bad when this match was over. This was not like an errant punch to the eye. So even Randy Orton, you know, you gotta be more careful with that shit. Daniel Bryan beat Jeff Hardy in the main event by DQ. He got an assist from Rowan. WWE has since announced a gauntlet match for SmackDown this Tuesday. All the participants in the Elimination Chamber for the WWE title will be part of this gauntlet. So it'll be Daniel Bryan, AJ Styles, Mustafa Ali, Randy Orton, Samoa Joe, and Jeff Hardy. On SmackDown this Tuesday, the winner of the gauntlet gets to enter the Chamber match last. So that is coming up on Tuesday.
Let me remind you, and I think a lot of people here will agree, NXT is way better than the WWE.
I didn't get a chance to talk about Halftime Heat last week since it aired after the podcast dropped. It was Aleister Black, Ricochet, Velveteen Dream against Tommaso Ciampa, Johnny Gargano, and Adam Cole in a live match from the Performance Center. It was officially the most watched match in NXT history when you account for all of the different platforms the match aired on. And what a match, you know, to be the most watched in history. I thought it was exactly what it needed to be. I thought it was a great match. And I saw some complaints about it being nothing more than a spot fest. I have no idea what these people were expecting. These people clearly do not understand how all of this works. You have 15 minutes, 20 at the most, including entrances, to show people, maybe people who have never seen the NXT product before, what NXT is all about. You want those 15 minutes to be action-packed, all action, nonstop, balls to the wall. You want to showcase their athleticism. You don't want to focus too much on any one particular story or storyline because you may have people who don't follow those stories week to week on NXT television. That's what the television show is for. That's not what this is meant to be. This was as much for the non-NXT watchers as it was for the hardcores. I thought it accomplished exactly what it needed to, and I love the setting at the PC. You know, it felt like one of those old studio shows. And they set it up in such a way where if you didn't see the whole backdrop where it just blatantly said Performance Center, you would never know that that is where the show took place from. So the babyfaces won. We did get to see Adam Cole hit a Panama Sunrise on Ricochet, which was cool. I thought for the time they had before the game came back on, they never slowed down. They made the most of it, and I thought it was great. On NXT television this past week, we had Johnny Gargano out there, first time at Full Sail as the North American champion. He was interrupted by Tommaso Ciampa, said that the final scene at TakeOver when they had their titles raised up in the air, he said that was our moment, which Gargano disputed. It wasn't our moment, he said. Anyway, Velveteen Dream came out. He made mention of winning the Worlds Collide tournament, which I have not had a chance to see. I watched one match from the Worlds Collide thing when the live stream was on YouTube, and I just didn't have time to watch the rest. But he said that this win entitles him to a championship opportunity at the title of his choosing, and he told Ciampa, I don't want your title, I want Gargano. He opted to go for the North American title, which I think really makes that title seem important. So I like that. That, and look, he already wrestled Tommaso Ciampa and he lost. So he wants a new challenge instead. Nothing wrong with that. So the match is slated to air in 2 weeks. That is on the February 20th episode of NXT. Jackson Ryker with a quick win over Mansoor. Mansoor is one of their Saudi Arabian prospects. He was one of the four Saudi prospects who were featured in that segment last year at the Greatest Royal Rumble, when the four of them were in the ring with the Daivari brothers. And then Arya Daivari had to apologize after that segment because he started getting death threats for waving around the Iranian flag. Then we had the debut of Eric Bugenhagen. Now, I only first heard of this guy maybe a month ago. He popped up on a video on the WWE PC channel on YouTube that I've told you all about. It may have been something like walking around the performance center and asking people what their New Year's resolutions were. It was something like that. And this guy just came out of nowhere. I had never seen him before. I'd never heard of him before. He's the star that you don't plan for. He's the one that just comes out of nowhere. He's not a big independent name. He's not a second or third generation star. He, I think, is a fan from childhood. He looks like a slightly jacked rock and roll musician straight out of the 1980s. He played air guitar on his way to the ring. He used the bottom rope as a keyboard. Full Sail went nuts for this guy. They ate it up. He became an overnight sensation after one episode. Now, of course, so did Adam Rose when he first debuted. Is this guy the next Adam Rose, or could he be something special? He's not just a silly gimmick. He's got a legit amateur wrestling background. He's big into weightlifting and bodybuilding. He has his own YouTube channel where he posts videos with lifting advice and his workout routines. The channel's been up for years. He wrestled Drew Gulak here on the show. Gulak was brought over from 205 Live, I guess, as the resident shooter here on NXT. And at least for 1 week. The look of pure disgust on the face of Drew Gulak as he watched all of these Bugenhagen shenanigans. I like the way that sounded, the Bugenhagen shenanigans. Watching this guy just act like a complete fool, and the look on Gulak's face, I wish I could frame it on my wall. It was priceless. He won with the Gulak. He got the tap out, so you know Bugenhagen loses in his first match. But after the match was over, Gulak grabs the mic, and he is just lamenting the fact that I came all the way here to NXT, and you guys give me Ben Stiller from Dodgeball as an opponent. And it's true. I hadn't thought about that until he said that, but he is Ben Stiller from Dodgeball, only, you know, more jacked. So he issued an open challenge to anybody in the back, and out came the King of Bros, Matt Riddle. And they traded some, ahead of match, they traded submission holds, and this was a lot of fun, I gotta say, watching these two. I'd love to see more matches between them. Although it ended pretty decisively. Riddle won with the Bromission, and Gulak grudgingly offered his hand. They shook hands, and he left. So I guess there's no reason to see the rematch, but I still would like to see it. And Io Shirai and Kairi Sane, the Sky Pirates, and along with Sam Roberts' favorite wrestler, Bianca Belair, beat Shayna Baszler, Marina Shafir, and Jessamyn Duke when Shirai pinned the champion with a moonsault. She tagged herself in before the finish, which seemed to bother Belair. So there's a little bit of friction there that they teased. After the match, you could tell that Bianca was not thrilled. She was smiling, but she was not. I think Kairi even grabbed her braid and was like swinging it around, and she jerked it away from her. So I can envision a number one contenders match in the next few weeks with Io Shirai and Bianca Belair and Kairi Sane to determine who challenges Shayna for the championship at TakeOver in Brooklyn. I assume it's going to be Io Shirai. This story kills me because I am a big fan of Lucha Underground, but I think what is going on there isn't right. King Cuerno filed a lawsuit this week against Baba G Productions, the production company for Lucha Underground, and also against the El Rey Network, which airs Lucha Underground, regarding his 7-season contract that prevents him, he claims it prevents him from working for other companies in the U.S. at a time when the wrestling scene here is booming, at least in terms of the opportunities that are out there for talent. According to Pro Wrestling Sheet, he is asking for arbitration. The suit notes that when he signed his deal with them in 2014, the wrestling landscape was very different than it is today. You know, today you've got WWE, you've got All Elite throwing around money, good money, to sign people. WWE just feels like they're stockpiling people for the sake of stockpiling them and taking them off the market and away from others. Ring of Honor, even, is offering better contracts now than they were 4 or 5 years ago. Impact stars, it says, the suit says, are also well paid. I'll take their word for it. They probably are. I mean, look, Chris Jericho made the comment a few weeks ago that he and Kenny Omega both came very, very close to signing with Impact. That's what he says. But, you know, he and Omega are very tight with Don Callis, so I can believe it. But that just means that if that was going to happen, clearly there's money, you know, in the coffers if Impact wants to throw some money around and sign a few big names, right? So even they seem to be sort of in the market for talent in a way that at one time they would not have been because they just didn't have the money for it. So anyway, the suit is alleging all of these things. And it says that most Lucha Underground contracts, and this blew my mind, are for less than $1,000 per episode. Obviously, some of the bigger names are getting a lot more than that. It says most wrestlers were making less than $4,000 per year, while those in other companies started at around $50,000. And bigger names can make six or seven figures. Cuerno claims that he has lost out on thousands of dollars and that he lost a job opportunity due to his Lucha Underground contract. Now, that's probably a reference to WWE. WWE had interest in him a couple of years ago. He wanted to go. He tried desperately to get out of his contract, and they would not allow it. Now, there's actually a second suit that has been filed as well. This is a class action suit claiming that these contracts are illegal. And you've got names attached to the suit like Ivelisse, who has said publicly that she's basically being held hostage right now by Lucha Underground. And she absolutely would be either in WWE or NXT or AEW right now. And it sucks that she's on ice because of this whole situation, because Ivelisse is very good. And I don't doubt for a second that wherever she goes, she would get over and she would be a big star in the women's division in any company. And she has been on a block of ice for the longest time now. And it's got to suck. I mean, imagine how frustrating it must be. Things seem to be exploding. Everybody's getting all these offers and all these bookings and all these opportunities, and you never hear her name mentioned. And she's one of many, but you never hear her name mentioned, and she absolutely should be. Joey Ryan is another one who's part of this class action suit, apparently. Cobra Moon is another one. I think it is unbelievably shitty that these people are stuck in limbo like this, with no sense whatsoever that Lucha Underground is even coming back for a fifth season. Like, it's one thing if it was like a where and when, but there's been nothing. There has been radio silence. So this whole situation is awful. But I also look at it and go, what did you expect when you signed seven season deals? You know what I mean? Like, what was the thought process that went into that? I mean, I guess the allure of this big TV show, I guess. But seven seasons, I mean, that's a long contract that they willingly put their names on. I'm sure that's the case that they would probably make in court. You know, I still don't think they deserve to be held hostage like this. And if it's costing them money and there's no word on a fifth season, those contracts should not be enforceable. I hope they win. I don't know how these contracts are worded. I don't know what the language of the contract is. Lucha Underground is a television show. It is not a wrestling promotion per se, so that changes things a little bit. But like Brock Lesnar did with WWE many years ago when he challenged them in court and ended up settling out of court with them. If these people are considered independent contractors, and again, maybe that isn't the case here because it's just a TV show, not a wrestling company. But if they are, you cannot deny them the opportunity to work. You cannot do that. I would think they would win, or at least would be able to reach some kind of agreement on this. In the meantime, the wheels of justice turn slowly. This is not going to be resolved in a matter of days or weeks. And they're still sitting there on the outside looking in at all these other people making all this money and getting all these opportunities. I mean, I've covered all four seasons of Lucha Underground on this podcast. I've been a big fan of theirs, even when a lot of you guys told me, you gave up after season two. You gave up after season three. Oh, season four is not as good. I heard a lot of that. I stuck with it. But this is horrendous. If they lose these people, plus the ones who have already left, I don't know that there's much of a roster left to have a show. And maybe they realize that, and that's why this is happening. At least give them some clarity. They deserve that much. Let them know, is there going to be a fifth season? You have to at least give them clarity on that. Let's take some of your questions from the mailbag here, and then we will get to number 9 in our weekly WrestleMania countdown that we started last week. You can always email me, thesolemonster@gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Michael in Liverpool, England. Off your discussion from last week about WWE possibly adding Charlotte to the Ronda Becky match at WrestleMania and making it an elimination match, looking back at the Nakamura AJ Styles match at last year's WrestleMania, which many felt was disappointing, should a third man have been added to that match to lower fan expectations, which were extremely high going into the show? For example, add Daniel Bryan, John Cena, or Randy Orton. No, because then you would have just pissed everybody off. People didn't want to see Randy Orton in that match. People didn't want to see Daniel Bryan or John Cena in that match. They wanted AJ Styles against Shinsuke Nakamura. That's the match the two of them wanted. Adding a third person would have just pissed everybody off. Now, were expectations so high, impossibly high to meet in the eyes of some fans? Yeah, probably. But they've had, even after that, they had better matches. They just did not have the best match that they could have had. And it was very disappointing for a lot of people. But adding a third person, I don't think would have made things any better. It would have just made people more upset because that's not the match they wanted to see. Right? The people who wanted to see AJ and Shinsuke go one-on-one wanted a one-on-one match. Ivan from Central Islip, New York. If Triple H did not get hurt before WrestleMania 23... would it have been a triple threat match at WrestleMania with Triple H, Shawn Michaels, and John Cena? I don't think so. We know what the original plan was because Shawn Michaels admitted it many years ago on one of his DVDs. He said as much. The plan was before Triple H tore his other quad, it was going to be Triple H against John Cena in a WrestleMania rematch from the previous year for the championship. And I think we all could probably figure out how that probably would have ended. I mean, look, I know Triple H lost back-to-back WrestleManias many years later to The Undertaker, but he's The Undertaker, right? So you can lose to him back-to-back times. I can't see him losing clean two straight years to John Cena. I just can't see that. But the rumor that seemed to get the most play at the time was that if Triple H did not tear his quad, it would have been Shawn Michaels as Donald Trump's surrogate against King Booker, who would have been Vince McMahon's surrogate in the Battle of the Billionaires. That seemed to be the prevailing rumor shortly thereafter that was likely. You don't know for sure. It's never been confirmed. But that was the belief at the time. It would have been Shawn in that spot instead of Bobby Lashley, and it would have been King Booker in that spot and not Umaga. And that you would have had two bigger names, and that would have been the Battle of the Billionaires match at WrestleMania. Bobby Lashley at the time was ECW champion, so he just would have probably defended the ECW title against somebody. Against who, I don't know. But that's probably how the card would have panned out. And for Umaga, who knows? He might have just been slotted into the Money in the Bank match, which I think is where Booker ended up being. So maybe they just would have swapped roles in that case. There really was no other obvious spot for Shawn Michaels. If not in the main event, and if not in the co-main event, you look at that card at that time, there's no other obvious spot for Shawn Michaels to be in on that card. I mean, maybe a match against Edge, or maybe a match against Randy Orton. You know, DX had been feuding at that time early in the year with Rated RKO. But I think that's where the friction started between Edge and Orton, so... if anything, I would think they would have wanted Orton and Edge against each other, like they were in the Money in the Bank ladder match. They were both part of that match. So I'm going to say the Battle of the Billionaires. Dan from the Philippines, do you think the millions of WWE fans will flock to watch the Double or Nothing event just to stick it to WWE? No, I do not. And that's the sort of thing that's going to get you laughed at. No, I do not. You're going to have some fans who check it out. There's millions of fans are going to watch All Elite first show. No. No. Dylan from Toronto. Was Europe the key to the Monday Night War is the title of his email here. In Bret Hart's book, he mentions that he believes one of the biggest reasons why WWE won the Monday Night Wars over WCW was because of their fan base in Europe. That gave WWE a huge worldwide advantage in the end, and WCW was really only big in the U.S. Do you agree, and can you explain this? Did WCW have a big worldwide following, or is that one of the many factors that brought their downfall? WWE was popular internationally. Actually, Bret Hart himself was very popular in certain parts of Europe. I think Germany. He always used to talk about how big he was in Germany. And I'm fairly certain that WWE had the edge over WCW when it came to international popularity. So Brett's not wrong about that. Where I think he's very wrong, where I disagree with him, is that that's why WWE won the Monday Night War, or that was the deciding factor in what gave WWE the win in the Monday Night War. And I'm just going based on what you're saying. I mean, maybe you're twisting Brett's words around. It's a kind of an odd thing to say. Of all things, to credit their win in this war to them having a little bit more in the way of international popularity. WWE was popular internationally in 1997 when they were on the verge at one point of bankruptcy. I didn't see that international popularity helping them too much then. Forget Monday nights. They were close to a bankruptcy filing before they followed WCW's lead, and they upped the price of their monthly pay-per-views. And they expanded them all to 3 hours, just like WCW was doing. That made the difference for them. That was the difference between, oh, hey, Brett, we can't afford to pay you anymore, so why don't you go negotiate with WCW? And then a few months later, oh, hey, Brett, guess what? We can pay you now. Oh, damn, you already went and signed a deal with WCW? You traitor, let me screw you. That's the kind of the after school short abbreviated version of what happened. That was a big factor, and WCW's own mismanagement and their inability to create new stars, that's what led to the tide turning in the Monday Night War. People just got sick of seeing the same old shit. WWF all of a sudden was the more appealing product to them, and the screw job helped. Right, Brett kind of had a role in that. That little thing called the Montreal Screwjob. When that happened, it led to the birth and the rise of the Mr. McMahon character and the whole Austin vs. McMahon feud. Those are all the reasons, of the many list of reasons, why WWE won that war, the Monday Night War, against WCW. Not the fact that they had more popularity in Europe than WCW. If you made a list of all the reasons that WWE won the war, that reason would not be top five. It might not even be top 10. Sean from Ohio. Who do you think is the greatest WWE champion of all time? Objectively, I think it almost has to be Bruno Sammartino. But I think Stone Cold Steve Austin and Bret Hart would also be fine choices. That would be my top three. Then you get to Hogan and the others. But I really, it's hard to imagine Bruno not being in that spot. Not just because he was champion for so freaking long, but just the impact that he had and the popularity that he had. And the company was a lot smaller, and it wasn't global and even really as national as it became later on. So it's hard to judge these things. But as popular as he was in the business that Bruno did, I mean, you could argue that you expand out to the West Coast and places like that, he's not as popular, but it's hard to not put him in that top spot. But yeah, I mean, right behind him, you've got to have Austin and Bret on that list. Sean in Edison, New Jersey. I came across a match on YouTube between the Nasty Boys and the Legion of Doom taped on the Arsenio Hall show. Do you have any memory of this? And if so, what did you think of it? Not only did I not have any memory of this when I got Sean's email, I don't think I ever saw this before until now. So I have to thank him, because it's the first time I had ever watched this, and I thought I had seen all of the Arsenio segments, because you can find most of them online. Arsenio used to have so many WWE personalities on his show. Macho Man and the Million Dollar Man. One of the funnier ones, you got to track it down. He had the Slickster and the Twin Towers, Boss Man and Akeem, on his show. In character. Totally in character. You've got to track that down and watch that. It's just, they stayed in character the entire time. Some of the things that were said, it's just unbelievable. You'd never see anything like that now. But anyway, so I found the video here that Sean was talking about. And there's a ring in the studio. It has a Survivor Series ring skirt. This was taped on November 21st, 1991. So that was a week before the Survivor Series pay-per-view, which is why they were there. They were there to promote the Survivor Series. The announce team for this match is unbelievable. Arsenio Hall and Jake the Snake Roberts in a suit and tie, no less. Jake is in a suit and a tie. He's got an earring in one ear. The same Jake the Snake who was in the middle of arguably his best heel run in the company. Only a few days later is when the segment aired on television, the snake bite incident, where the snake bit the Macho Man. Gnawed away at Randy Savage's arm. And there he is sitting in a suit and tie next to Arsenio Hall. Jake was supposed to wrestle on that pay-per-view. He was supposed to wrestle at Survivor Series. He was the captain, in fact, of a team that would have had IRS and the natural disasters, which just doesn't seem right that he was going to team with Earthquake. He was going to team with Earthquake the same year that he made Quake Burgers out of Damien. Come on. But they were going to face the team of Sid Justice, the Big Boss Man, and the Legion of Doom. Sid suffered that fall a bicep injury, I guess a bicep tear, and he was taken out of the show. In fact, it was originally going to be Sid, not Randy Savage, in that spot. Sid was going to be the one to get bitten by the King Cobra. You know, people forget that it was really the feud at that time, even though, you know, they crashed the wedding party with Savage and Liz. That's really how that whole thing got started. It was Sid who made the save in that segment, and the feud coming out of that, Savage was still not suspended, but he had retired. He was doing commentary. He wasn't an active wrestler. The feud was going to be Jake and Sid, not Jake and Randy Savage. So that snakebite, assuming Sid would have agreed to it, I don't know if he was as crazy as Macho was originally going to be Sid getting bitten on the arm by that snake. You know, and to think, one of my favorite feuds almost didn't happen were it not for that injury. There's no way that feud would have worked nearly as well if it had been Sid in that spot. But anyway, Mean Gene Okerlund is there. And Mean Gene handles the ring announcing. They even had a member of the Temptations. This guy, Ollie Woodson, comes out. He sings the national anthem like this is some big sporting event. The fucking Super Bowl here in this little studio. Mean Gene sits down to do play-by-play. What a three-man booth. The three-man booth I bet you never knew existed. Mean Gene Okerlund, Jake the Snake Roberts, and Arsenio Hall. Still better than Michael Cole, Corey Graves, and Renee Young. Hawknail sags with a clothesline at one point. Arsenio drops this line. I couldn't believe he said this. He hits the clothesline. Arsenio goes, oh, that's the move they use on Rodney King. Could not believe my ears. I would have expected that on WWE television, to be honest with you, but I wouldn't have expected that out of Arsenio's mouth. Even Jake. Now think about that, right? Jake the Snake is on commentary going, geez, when he heard that line. LOD wins with the Doom. Well, of course they do. They win with the Doomsday Device. Jake gets angry. He pulls the King Cobra out of the bag. He cuts a promo on LOD from afar. Arsenio gets the fuck out of Dodge. He doesn't want any part of that snake. I don't blame him. And then, as he's throwing it to commercial, there's all this chaos and havoc and pandemonium, and Arsenio's walking away, and he's throwing it to commercial as they're going over break. He goes, we'll be right back with Howie Mandel and Bill Cosby. So Jake may not have been the biggest heel in the building that night. You know, somebody in the comments section made a point about how Arsenio should be in the celebrity wing of the WWE Hall of Fame. He's not wrong. He really isn't. I thought they would have put Regis Philbin in there by now. You know, Regis is, he was a good friend to them, and he had a lot of wrestlers on his show at a time when his show, you know, in the daytime was very popular. That's another thing you should look up on YouTube. Some of these old Regis and Kathy Lee episodes are unbelievable. You see these guys in character. Fucking Mr. Fuji and Yokozuna walk out there on Regis and Kathy Lee. You know, the Undertaker and Paul Bearer. Full character. They're out there on Regis and Kathy Lee. It's like, you watch these things. Ultimate Warrior was on there, Raving Psycho. I mean, some of these interviews are just unbelievable. And they're all on YouTube. But I would have expected Regis to be, you know, honored by now for all the exposure he gave them. Arsenio did the same. You got to give the guy credit. He had a ton of WWF guys on his show over the years, including, well, I mean, he had that one interview, I guess, the infamous interview with Hulk Hogan that they probably would not want to show highlights of, where he was supposed to be coming on the show to admit all these newspaper stories were in the news. This was when the steroid thing was blowing up in the early 90s. And Hogan was at the heart of it. And I think Arsenio and his producers were expecting, we got the scoop, Hogan's going to come out, he's going to admit and tell the story about his steroid use, and boy, did they not get what they were hoping for. Hogan changed his mind right before he walked out, did a 180. I only took steroids 3 times in my life. In 1983, I was the champion. He wasn't, by the way. He was the champion in 84. But I only took it to heal an injury. You can see the guy's nose grow by 20 feet during that interview. And him coming out lying on Arsenio Hall did the company no favors at that time. That was a bad, bad day at the office for Hulk Hogan and for WWF. A bad look for them. And that happened on our Arsenio show. But, you know, look, that one they could probably just leave alone. But if they ever put a video package together, they certainly have a lot of other highlights they could be showing of all the wrestlers that went on his show. I guess Arsenio, like Regis now, they're kind of old news now to WWE, right? They're not big enough celebrity names for them to really do anything with. And it's a shame. You think of people like them, you think of Cyndi Lauper. Maybe it's her choice. Maybe she just, I mean, she's done stuff with WWE since. She was on Raw a few years ago with Wendi Richter. Maybe she doesn't want to go in. Everybody yells at WWE, how come you're not putting Cyndi Lauper in? Maybe it's her choice. Maybe they've tried. Who knows? But those are some names I think that if you're going to honor different celebrities, I think they deserve to be honored.
What did we just see? What did we just see? It's WrestleMania, baby!
Last week, I started a new countdown, a WrestleMania-themed countdown of the top 10 most shocking WrestleMania match outcomes. One per week on the road to WrestleMania 35. Number 10 last week was Ravishing Rick Rude pinning the Ultimate Warrior to win the Intercontinental title at WrestleMania 5. This week, number 9 in the countdown, takes us back to WrestleMania 2000, a show that had Ice-T singing The Godfather down to the ring. Yes, Detective Odafin Tutuola once appeared at WrestleMania. And a show that had exactly one singles match, and I use that word match, by the way, very loosely. One out of 9 matches on the show that had, it was a cat fight between the cat, of course, and Terry Runnels. That was just absolutely awful. And it lasted all of 2 minutes, thank God, where the rules were that to win, you had to throw your opponent out of the ring. You know, it's funny, I've called 2000 WWE's best year creatively, and one of the best years in company history, but it had one of the worst WrestleManias. Not the worst, but it had one of the worst WrestleMania shows, top to bottom. So go figure. But do yourself a favor, though, in terms of the year 2000. Go back and watch the Royal Rumble, watch Backlash, watch Judgment Day, watch Fully Loaded, and watch SummerSlam. Watch those shows. You'll be hard-pressed to find another year, I think, with as many quality WWE pay-per-views as we got that year. But number 9 is Triple H, retaining his WWE Championship in a fatal 4-way main event with a McMahon in every corner. It was Triple H with Stephanie McMahon defending against The Rock with Vince McMahon, Big Show with Shane McMahon, and Mick Foley with the always charismatic Linda McMahon in his corner. A few things on this. I remember being really amped up for this show, so much so that I sat through, and I don't know how many of you actually remember this WrestleMania All Day Long special that they did that year. You think the pre-shows now add to the length of these shows? This was an 8-hour long pre-show that started at noon. It wasn't like a live pre-show with a panel and all that. But they started this thing at noon Eastern. It was hosted by Michael Cole and Ivory. It's probably better than WrestleMania itself, honestly. They did a hell of a job with it. They showed highlights from every WrestleMania up to that point. They had interviews spliced in with some of the key players, talking about things that were happening behind the scenes at the time and what was going through their mind with this match and that match. It was really well done. It was very good. I hung with it the entire time. I had my chips and I was parked right in front of the TV and I was ready. And save for a few piss breaks in between, I was there for the whole thing. And it led directly into the pay-per-view. The main event that year should have been Triple H defending the WWF title against The Rock. They were the top heel and the top babyface in the company at the time. Those were the two guys carrying the load. In Stone Cold's absence, Stone Cold was on the shelf after neck surgery, and Rock should have gotten the big babyface win to close out the show, but The Rock botched the finish of the Royal Rumble match. His feet clearly touched the floor when they weren't supposed to. He still won, but they turned it into a storyline with Big Show coming on TV and proclaiming, "I have footage, I have footage." And that footage clearly showed that he got screwed at the Royal Rumble. Now, I can't sit here and say for sure that the plan had been for them to do Rock and Triple H one-on-one. But the Rumble botch changed that because they couldn't just ignore it. My impression is that's the reason, though, for them wanting to do a four-way. They had to get the Big Show in there, but they didn't want it to just be a triple threat. So they wanted to add a fourth person. That fourth person originally was not supposed to be Mick Foley. Foley had lost to Triple H in a Hell in a Cell match at No Way Out in February of that year. That was basically supposed to be his retirement match. That was the end of his career, supposedly. I mean, we all know how that works. But two straight pay-per-view matches, he put over Triple H like $1 million, and now he was going to go right off into the sunset. Chris Jericho talks in his second book about the fact that his face was on the WrestleMania, one of the original anyway, WrestleMania posters that year, alongside The Rock and Triple H and Big Show. This was not like, well, it's just a medley of different performers in the poster. No, it had Rock, it had Triple H, and it had Big Show, all of whom happened to be in the main event that year, and next to them, I think on the far left, was Chris Jericho. And from that, in his book, he deduced that he was going to be included in the main event of WrestleMania that year. He's very excited about this. Then a few weeks before the show, he saw that his face on the poster had been replaced by Mick Foley. And it was like a punch to the gut. And you can find that poster, by the way, with Jericho. It's not a Photoshop. It's a legitimate poster. You can find it online. And you'll see that he's right there with the other three. So it does exist. Had Jericho been in that match, we probably never would have gotten that phantom title change on Raw a few weeks later with him and Triple H, which is one of the all-time great segments in Raw history. Foley, for his part on one of his DVDs, claimed that Vince told him that he wanted him to end his career not without having a WrestleMania main event. This is what he claims Vince told him. And so Vince decided to put Foley in the match. He wanted him to have his WrestleMania match, his WrestleMania main event. And it's a shame because Foley did not come off well in that match. And they had that embarrassing spot where he fell short. He did the diving elbow off the apron to the announce table outside. He fell a little bit short, hit the side of the table. It would have been far better for him to go out. And I laugh when I say that because, of course, that turned out to not be his last match anyway. But to go out with those two Triple H matches, I think, would have been a hell of a way to end his career. Unless they were bringing him back to win the championship. If they're like, "Hey, Mick, we want to bring you back. We're going to put you over. For what you did for Hunter and all that, we're going to put you over in this match. We're going to put the title on you, and then you can retire as the champion, and we'll have the title vacant, and we'll have a tournament or whatever." If that was going to be their plan, I guess that would have been a nice little thank you from... Actually, that would be a big thank you from them. That I can understand. But the way they did things here, it was pointless. So they got Big Show out of this match really quick. Like, less than 5 minutes. Foley stayed in there for a while longer. But then it finally came down to The Rock and Triple H, which is what this should have been from the start. I can't complain too much because we got a great match at Backlash the following month between Triple H and Rock. That's the one where Steve Austin comes rampaging down to the ring. He kills six people with a steel chair. one of the longest sustained ovations ever. From the moment that glass shattered until the moment Earl Hebner counted the three for The Rock and awarded him with the championship. Unbelievable. And I'll never forget all these people online talking about Fat Stone Cold when that show was over. Like how it looked like, oh, he looked like he had a giant gut when he walked out to the ring. Oh, shocking, I know, right? From a guy coming off neck surgery who was in a freaking halo for 3 months. Shocking that he would put on some weight. Anyway, Shane and Vince, they go at it at ringside during the match. It's all about the McMahon. Some things never change. They're fighting back and forth. And I think Shane even hit Vince in the head with a television monitor. And Vince bladed, so now he's bleeding. This is all going on in the middle of the match, right? You would think these guys really hate each other. Hits his father in the head with a chair. Vince eventually comes back to the ring. He beats up Shane, knocks Shane out of the ring. Great theater here between these two, given what was about to happen. Vince picks up a chair. He teases hitting his son-in-law with it. And instead, he hits his guy with it. He hits The Rock right in the head with the chair. Jim Ross is apoplectic on commentary. Even Earl Hebner's yelling at Vince, what the hell do you think you're doing? Triple H goes for the cover. Rock kicks out. Now, you would expect him to kick out because I don't think anybody honestly believed that Triple H would leave that show as the champion. Except, he did. Vince hit Rock with the second chair shot. I thought for sure Rock was going to block it or give him a rock bottom. But he hit him in the head with the chair. Vince yells at Earl Hebner, get your ass down and count. And he counts the three. A shocking finish. Because you just did not see the heel retaining and ending WrestleMania with a pinfall win. It's not anything you ever saw before at WrestleMania. You just didn't see it. Instead, it was McMahon-O-Mania compounded by a shit finish that people hated. And what makes the McMahon crap so much worse is that none of it made any sense. If Vince's plan all along in this match was to screw The Rock and make sure he did not win the WWF title, and made sure that his son-in-law would keep it, then why wait so long, 40 minutes almost, to do the turn? It was idiotic. It was no less idiotic than all the other times that we've seen people do the same thing in wrestling. This is not the first time that this has happened. But to end your WrestleMania main event with this nonsense is just inexcusable. Was it a shocking outcome? You bet your ass it was. It only delayed the inevitable, though. I mean, Rock won the title the following month. And Triple H and him went on to have an Iron Man match a month after that. Triple H won the belt back. And then they had a six-man tag team match at the King of the Ring the month after that. Guess what? Rock won the title back. Back and forth, back and forth. Hey, look, I never said 2000 was perfect. They played hot potato with their world title way too much there in the middle of the year. But 2000, you got to remember, 2000 also gave us Kurt Angle's rookie year. It gave us the birth of the TLC matches with Edge and Christian and the Hardys and the Dudleys and sort of the rise of the tag team division there. It gave us the Love Triangle storyline, which I was digging up until they just ended it out of nowhere and I thought that sucked. But the Love Triangle storyline with Triple H and Kurt Angle and Stephanie. It gave us the Radicals when they jumped over from WCW. It gave us the most badass version of Kane ever, I think. I mean, I love the original Kane gear, but when he came back at the beginning of 2000, the way he was all decked out, there was nobody. I mean, this guy was built like a brick shithouse. You got to look at this guy. Early to mid-2000 Kane looks like this unstoppable, just monster badass. And 2000 also gave us the American Badass Undertaker. Which I will freely admit, I did not appreciate at the time. I was no fan. But I've warmed up to that version, that incarnation of The Undertaker more as the years have gone on. To the point where a few years ago when he was teasing, you know, WrestleMania comeback, there were rumors he was going to come out on the motorcycle and do the American Badass gimmick. I was disappointed when he didn't. I kind of wanted to see him come back as that. I kind of missed the days where The Undertaker would actually speak like a gang member instead of as a zombie corpse. But I guess those days are over. So Keep sending in your mailbag questions to me. As I've mentioned before, these countdown segments, I cut them up. I put them up on the YouTube channel every Wednesday. I have created a new playlist, so when we run through the entire list, all of the different segments, all of the top 10 matches will be archived there for your viewing and listening pleasure if you ever want to go back and refer to them and listen to them again. So that is when they go up on YouTube. On Friday is when the retro content goes up on the YouTube channel. I am about to actually wrap up the top 9 countdown of my greatest WWE promos and interviews of all time. We're going to be doing number 1 this week. And when that ends, the following Friday, there will be more retro content going up when I cover the top 15 WCW matches. Top 15 greatest WCW matches in history. These are older countdowns that I've done in the last like 2 or 3 years. If you're wondering, hey, have you done that before? That's why it's called retro. A lot of people never heard these segments before. A lot of these had been archived on YouTube and on TV tracks, and now they're not up anymore. So I want them all archived and organized on our channel, on my channel. And it's just a lot easier when I have full control over these things. So anyway, a lot of good content going up there. Again, help us on the road to 50,000. Subscribe. I appreciate the hell out of it. Follow me on Twitter, at Solomonster. I will be back next Sunday for episode 586. That is also Elimination Chamber Sunday. So I'm not sure if it'll be on the episode. Well, either way, it'll be on the episode next week. I'll have predictions. I'll try to get the predictions up a couple days early if I can. Another reason why you should go sub to the YouTube channel. Check it every day. These notifications are just on the fritz. So some people tell me they don't even get notifications when new content goes up. I don't know what's going on with YouTube. Just make it a point to check the channel, if not every day, every other day, because I'm constantly putting new stuff up there, trying to. So anyway, I'm out of here. My voice is shot from the show last night and now this. So I bid you adieu. Have yourselves a great week. I will see you back here next weekend for more Sound Off. Until then, be well, stay safe. And the people I saw last night at the House of Glory show, anybody who took pictures or anything, upload them. Put them on Twitter or Facebook and tag me, or, you know, whatever. Tag me and I'll retweet it and share it. I forgot to mention that earlier. So I'm out of here. I'll see you next week. Take care, guys.
The good, the bad, and the ugly. The Solomonster sounds off.
And there was one moron who tagged me in a tweet. He says, Smarks like everything from Japan. This guy has a picture of The Rock as his avatar, and he's quoting wrestling catchphrases on his timeline, calling other people Marks and Smarks when you've got another man as your profile picture and you're quoting Psycho Sid. Sit the fuck down with that nonsense. You don't get to sit at the adult table when you spew nonsense like that. Go stand in the corner and face the wall.
Solomonster sounds off. Since 2007, the Solomonster sounds off. Available at thesolomonster.com, Stitcher Radio, TuneIn Radio, iTunes, and more.
Solomonster sound off. What's that boy? Dad, over there. Is that Yeti?
It's just his hair, son.
At last, saved after all these years. Stuck up this cursed mountain, licking moss with only a crow for a friend. How'd you find me?
Just walking the dog. Need a lift back down?
Room for a crow?
Adventures never far with the Land Rover Discovery Sport. Now £339 per month on Land Rover personal contract hire.
Oh, heated seats.
Land Rover. Above and beyond.
Initial rental £4,068. 48th month term. Subject to status. 8,000 miles per annum. Conditions apply. Offer ends 31st of March. Participating retailers only. Such Land Rover offers.